Speaking of Parliament, to the 4th of June 2013, suspension of standing orders, the Honourable the Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move under Standing Order 7.3 to suspend Standing Order 7.1 in order to proceed with a government statement and to lay the fishing report on the table. Those in favour? Carried.
The Honourable Minister for Health and Environment.
Mr. Speaker, Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar is today publishing the independent expert report on the management of marine living resources in the waters around Gibraltar, which has been produced by the working group set up last year to consider and report on these matters. The report analyzes the international context of marine protection, assesses in depth the range of fisheries data and other information available, and identifies the gaps that exist. The report reflects the views of the authors, who are experts in this field, and has not in any way been influenced by government. Its main conclusions are that the basis for the vote of environmental protection laws are sound. Information currently available is insufficient to provide clear results on the state of fish stocks. Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar should therefore continue to act in keeping with established precautionary principles of conservation and pursue active management of the marine environment, and future changes to environmental management must be dependent on these issues. Since receipt of the report, Mr. Speaker, Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar has been considering its recommendations and preparing a marine strategy for Gibraltar. The full effect of this strategy will be seen in months to come and will include 1. Regulations to control marine recreational activities that will allow these while providing safeguards for the local environment and support for Gibraltar sea users. These regulations will in particular affect diving activities and web fishing, and will be published very shortly. 2. Increased resources for environmental protection and enforcement. 3. Measures to increase the population of all marine species. 4. Increased monitoring and collection of data to allow for the ability to respond quickly to changes. 5. A review of current management based on the success and predicted success of the above initiative. The planned strategy will make allowance for changes to laws to allow sustainable fishing practices with sustainable fishing methods where all the relevant local stakeholders consider it would be appropriate. Details of each specific action and revised legislation, all of which are currently being worked on, will be published in the coming weeks and months, with the whole process being completed in the autumn. The forthcoming legislation, which has been discussed with all the relevant major local stakeholders, including the Nature Conservancy Council, Nature Conservation NGOs, angling, spearfishing, and diving groups, and commercial operators, will be published and will introduce the essential principle of active management of our marine resources. This will include the ability to respond quickly to changes in the status of said resources as detected by improved monitoring systems, while measuring and enabling the sustainable use of the habitat naturally surrounding us. The report will be very shortly, Mr. Speaker, available on the government website within the next half hour, and printed copies can be obtained from the Department of the Environment at UK.
The Honourable the Leader of the
Opposition. Mr. Speaker, certainly on this side of the House, we welcome the publication of the report. We think that it doesn't come as a soon. Indeed, we believe that it probably comes months too late. That being the case, despite that being the case, We welcome the publication of the report and we will consider it very carefully. The government knows, because we have made statements on numerous occasions from this side of the House, that whatever solution is proposed that is reasonable in order to deal not only with the question of management of the environment and management of systems, but also solution to the current African crisis, we will certainly support. I note that the Honourable the Minister has said in his speech, I think it is 6, that the government intends to allow sustainable fishing methods. We will obviously examine that very carefully as to what the government means by that, allowing Spanish fishermen to fish with nets of some kind during some part of the year. But as I say, certainly on this side of the House, the government will find that despite our criticism of the handling of the crisis by the and the handling of this particular issue by the government, it will find the opposition supportive in any solution that it brings to this House by way of legislation.
Just on a point of order, do you have any sense to say that it was intended in that way? So the suggestion that we could have recourse to the government website for copies was not intended for us, but rather for the public in the hearing. I think I'd add anybody.
Papers to be read, the Honourable Minister for Health and Environment. As a speaker, I have the honour to lay on the table the fishing report. Order to lie.
Copies of the description.
Government motion, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Crisis for crisis.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move the motion standing in my name, which reads as follows. This House welcomes the work done by the Independent Commission on Democratic and Parliamentary Reform. Further welcomes that the Commission was able to report to the House ahead of schedule. Notes and welcomes that the Commission has made clear recommendations in proposing areas of reform for the workings of this Parliament and for democratic reform, and will now consider in this meeting those recommendations in detail. Speaker, we and the government members have met and considered your report in some detail, and we've agreed the position of the parties represented on this side of the House. I therefore speak on behalf of the government on the recommendations which arise from your report. And I want to do so, Mr. Speaker, by starting the debate in this motion with a thank you to you and all the members of your Commission on Democratic and Parliamentary Reform for the very timely submission of your report. Because you've done the work of the Commission in much shorter order than we had anticipated was possible. Indeed, during the course of the debate on this subject before the last general election, when both sides of the House put their respective positions on the subject of parliamentary reform, it was suggested that our idea of creating a Commission on Democratic and Parliamentary Reform was an attempt to put this very important subject into the long grass. I think we've demonstrated that this is not the case in a number of ways, not least, Mr. Speaker, the speed at which your Commission has been able to report. But the first, Mr. Speaker, has been by implementing a number of deep and, dare I say, revolutionary reforms in the workings of our Parliament immediately after our election. Not least of which, Mr. Speaker, has been my own convening of regular monthly meetings of the Parliament. That, Mr. Speaker, we think has delivered a dramatic change that has been qualitative and not just quantitative in bringing us to this Parliament every month. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, you will know that there have been in previous Parliament two or three question times, for example, in any 1 year. Since our election, there's been a monthly Chief Minister's question time that I think has now become a part of the natural democratic rhythm of this democracy. Mr. Speaker, I think that this is more than just about numbers of meetings. This is about the quality of our democracy. And I think it's right to say that we can be justly proud on this side of the House, and I can be justly proud as Chief Minister to have ushered in this new era in our democratic development as a people. And it's not just me, Mr. Speaker, that has to come here to answer questions on a monthly basis. All ministers do. The whole government holds itself up to scrutiny on a monthly basis. And that's the sort of democracy that many countries actually don't enjoy. And I'm delighted, Mr. Speaker, that there will always be, that I will always be able to boast, and that we on this side of the House will always be able to boast, that as soon as we have the power to deliver this change, we implemented it without hesitation. The issue now, Mr. Speaker, for us is how we entrench this change in legislation or in rules, so that whilst we respect the primacy of Parliament and the right of any new administration to use its majority in this House to convene meetings as it may see fit, we go as far as possible to entrenching this monthly procedure so that it cannot be undone by a new administration without explaining to the House what it is that they intend to do in place thereof. And I think that's one of the issues that we have to consider today. There are many other things which we've read in your committee's report and in your recommendations, which we have also already done.
I would be very grateful if the Chief Minister and all members have referred into the report where it was referred to as being the Commission's report. It is not my report, it is not my personal report, there are four other people, and it is not the Speaker's report. It is a report of the Commission which, for historical reasons, I happened to chair, and I think it would be much more accurate to refer to it as the Commission's report. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I shall do so, mindful of the fact that although you said it, as you rightly say, it's not your report, it's the Commission's report. If I stray into referring it to it once again as your report, please don't hesitate to pick me up on it. But there are other things that we have read in the Commission's report, Mr. Speaker, which we've already dealt with or are dealing with, and we would like that to be seen as a vindication of the findings of the Commission and illustrative of our commitment to positive reform of the workings of our Parliament and of our democracy more widely. So as I go through the recommendations, I think it will be evident that in many instances we've already implemented some of them, or we're in the process of implementing them. Mr. Speaker, the approach to a number of recommendations of your commission, of the Commission, in the spirit of wanting to go even further in the modernisation of the workings of Parliament, and mindful of the need for this place to operate as effectively and openly as possible, and trying to combine those two criteria. What I propose to do, Mr. Speaker, is to take the Parliament through the recommendations one by one, indicating our support, our concern, or our disagreement with each of them in turn, and the reasons for that concern, support, or disagreement. Because I cannot say that we accept all the recommendations, although in most instances where we have felt the need to disagree with recommendations, I think you'll find that we do so on technical grounds. Mr. Speaker, then having heard the contributions of all parliamentary colleagues who might wish to speak on the subject, I will propose that the motion then be amended to include reference to those recommendations as it's proposed or should be accepted by Parliament today after the debate. But I discussed in passing with the speaker how best to proceed with the honourable the backbencher, or we do have one already, Speaker Mr. Kahana, during the last sitting of the House, and I agreed with his suggestion, and he may want to say something about it later on, that we should not turn this particular debate into one about final acceptance and implementation of the recommendations made, but rather that we should have a debate today on principles, with matters of implementation and the detail of that, left for that much more detailed consideration required, probably by a select committee. I'll therefore also be proposing, Mr. Speaker, that the amendments to be moved to the motion as it stands today, after honourable members who wish to do so have made their contribution, should refer to those recommendations that the whole House believes can be accepted, and to the creation of a new and bespoke.
We may have a procedural problem, and that is in making the amendment. At what stage is the amendment going to be made? Is it at the stage when the Honourable the Chief Minister exercises his right to reply? I am not sure that that is procedurally correct.
There is a right to move an amendment at any time. We can either agree that I should be proposing an amendment when the last speaker on the other side is about to end and give way. And of course, once I propose an amendment, others will also have the right to speak again. Or I can propose the amendment, or I can propose the amendment during the course of my reply.
If the Honourable Minister proposes an amendment during the course of his right to reply, then of course that amendment is again open to before the House and present to everybody. We do that.
Because the way I intended to deal with it would be that I would deal with the matters that are raised by members opposite in my reply initially, and then I would move to say, right, having said all that, this is what I think can be distilled into an amendment, and this is what I think that the Select Committee procedure should look like. I don't think that this, the recommendations of the committee are an issue for any of the existing standing committees, although you could probably form some of them into some of the existing committees, as I think some of the recommendations go well beyond the rules and the standing order. And in fact, in some instances, the recommendations may require legislative changes or even new parliamentary acts which need to be brought to the House as bills. I therefore be proposing that the new Select Committee should be known as the Select Committee on the Implementation of the Accepted Recommendations of the Independence Commission on Democratic and Parliamentary Reform, a mouthful though that is, and I also propose in shorthand the committee should be known as the Select Committee on Parliamentary Reform. Again, Mr. Speaker, we believe that this is a necessary step in order to advance matters quickly, but also with full cognizance of the implications of any amendment and having the opportunity to look at the detail of how to implement each of the recommendations offline, so to speak, in the context of a Select Committee environment. I also be proposing, Mr. Speaker, that the Select Committee when established should be made up of 3 members of the government and 2 from the opposition, as is the traditional format. And having said all of that as to how I intend to deal with the debate today, let me turn, without further ado, to the numbered recommendations of your report, taking each one in turn, although I do intend to take the first 2 together as the Commission presents them. Recommendation number 1 reads as follows. We recommend that standing orders be amended to require Parliament to hold a minimum of 10 meetings a year, other than in the year when a general election is held. Recommendation number 2, Mr. Speaker, reads as follows. We recommend that Parliament should continue to have its Christmas and Easter recesses, but the summer recess should last from the end of July to the 3rd week in September. Well, Mr. Speaker, we've already introduced this monthly meeting procedure, as I was saying, and therefore, unhesitatingly agree that the first 2 recommendations, which are giving effect to our policies, in effect, in respect of the regularity of meetings, should be accepted by the Parliament. And the issues that are left in respect of those recommendations, I think, are ones for the Select Committee that looks at the detail of this, rather than for the House today, which is, first of all, how do we entrench this requirement for monthly meetings, conscious of the fact, of course, that the Constitution provides for a different requirement of regularity, so there will be a legislative or a rule-based regularity, and there will be a constitutional requirement of regularity, and that those may be different. The recommendation of the Commission refers to a standing order, but it may be necessary that the Select Committee decide that actually it's an amendment to the Parliament Act that's required and is not required desirable, and that that may actually lend itself to the rhythm of meetings being more regular without the Chief Minister having to actually convene them in every month, but that we have a clear criteria set out, either in legislation or in rules, subject to the Leader of the House being able to certify some exceptional circumstances when a specific meeting should not be held, or going beyond particular dates that you've been proposing. For example, Mr. Speaker, the refurbishment of the Parliament required that we didn't have a March meeting, even though we were already in the rhythm of voluntarily calling meetings on a monthly basis. And we may very well want or need to sit in August, Mr. Speaker. I'm reminded of the events of last year, and also the events of the tercentenary, where we wanted to meet on a specific date in August to commemorate the 300 years on the date when it was particularly relevant. There may be, for example, a week where August starts on a Thursday or a Friday, and there may be no reason why the Parliament should not be able to use that final week of July as a full parliamentary week. And just because the 1st of August might be on a Friday, we shouldn't put ourselves in strictures that we are not able to use those days for parliamentary business where relevant. Even then, Mr. Speaker, when we do that, we'll still be turning the current position on its head. I mean, at the moment, we need to understand the current position is that simply the Constitution bites and requires us to have three meetings in the year, and therefore we are voluntarily calling these meetings. So by putting in rules, even if we allow for this potential leeway, we're turning the current position on its head and entrenching the principle of the monthly meeting. I think it's important there should be a clearly understood power for meetings of the Parliament to be called at short notice. And we deal with the Commission deals with the issue of notice period specifically in its recommendation. But the reason for mentioning this now, Mr. Speaker, is that under our current setup, any convocation of a meeting of the House is a meeting for questions, motions, bills, and all the other business of the House. And I think that the Speaker of the Leader of the House, whoever he should be in a position to convene a meeting of the House on 24-hour notice. I note that the Speaker that there's something in standing orders about emergency meetings of the House, but there's not much in it at the moment, and I think it may be useful for the Select Committee to look at this and flesh out those rules a little bit more so that they're understood by all members, and that power might be used in a more current and modern context. So that instead of just having emergency meetings, perhaps we should have something called extraordinary meetings, which are not uncommon in all democracies, where parliaments can be convened or even recalled at times of national emergency, tragedy. All of those probably come within, or the first of those probably comes within the definition of emergency. Tragedy probably doesn't come within anybody's definition of emergency. I'm conscious of the fact that we lost a member of the House, and we might all have wanted to come here to recognise that together at that moment. Or in the context of great celebration, where the House and Parliament is to play its natural role in the administration of the affairs of the people, may want to have an extraordinary meeting to simply mention a particularly successful event, like, for example, the Gibraltar football team winning the European Cup of Nations, when I'm sure they will do before this decade is out, if the desirable Gibraltarians have anything to go by. So anyway, having that power to come on 24 hours notice without engaging the full gamut of bill, question, etc. procedure, I think is something that needs to be fleshed out a little bit beyond simply the emergency power, which seems to be the one contained in standing orders as it is at the moment. The recommendation number 3, which I move on to now, deals with question time. And you say this, we recommend, or the Commission says this, we recommend that question time should be guillotined and that the Chief Minister should answer questions, including supplementary questions, but not more than 3 hours a month, and each minister for not more than 2 hours a month. When it's specific, call me a glutton for punishment, but we don't agree that there should be a specific time limit or a time guillotine on questions being asked by opposition members, even though that is actually the case in most parliaments. Indeed, although you don't point it out in the report, the UK Parliament involves the procedure for Prime Minister's question time, allowing members half an hour to question the Prime Minister in parliamentary sessions weekly whilst the Parliament is in session. We believe it's in essence that the time spent in supplementary should be entirely a matter in Mr. Speaker's discretion and based on relevance to the subject matter of the original question. It's been clear to us for many years that the rules on parliamentary questions and supplementaries have been honoured by their breach and not by their observance, and I'm not casting aspersions on members who are sitting opposite today, and for that reason, as I've said many years. And you have been highly critical, Mr. Speaker, I may say so, of both sides of the House in your interventions in the recent months of your appointment because of our approach to question time, and you said repeatedly you remain vigilant and that we should be more circumspect in the way that that both sides of the House approach the question and answer equation. I think that we've demonstrated our respect for your views on these matters, but with a clear approach that's based on the existing rules of relevance and supplementary, short, sharp questions and answers being equally short and sharp whilst remaining informative, and I'm confident that with those rules observed, there would be no need for a time guillotine. Essentially, arguing as a speaker, that the guillotine should be led by subject and by relevance, and not by time, with the caveat that each question should not last very long, but without a time limit. We've seen and we've mentioned that some questions have gone on for half an hour, and should certainly not be allowed to turn into these mini debates that they have become, certainly since I have been in this Parliament from 2003. We're all aware, Mr. Speaker, in the United Kingdom, each question would not last more than a few minutes, because after that, the supplementaries stray from the relevance of the original question, which is from where relevance should be measured. I mean, relevance should not be measured from each supplementary as we move away from the original subject of the question. As you know better than us, Mr. Speaker, relevance should be measured from the original question and not from the supplementary. And in that context, Mr. Speaker, we think that relevance should be the blade and the guillotine and not the cross. But in addition to the form, Mr. Speaker, of the Commission says this, we recommend that if a table question for oral answer is not reached during the time allowed in Recommendation Number 3, the Minister to whom it is addressed should provide the answer in writing and let the questioner withdraw the question or table it for answer at a subsequent meeting. For the reasons I've indicated already, Mr. Speaker, when dealing with your third recommendation, with the Commission's third recommendation, we don't think that this recommendation is relevant. But of course, it's something that could be made use of at any time if members opposite felt, for example, that the information that they've obtained in relation to one particular question is such that they would rather not continue with a particular question, say that they would be happy for it to be answered in writing. I can't see the circumstances where members opposite would wish to have that mechanism engaged. If there is an oral answer ready in the Parliament, they may as well have it, even if it's passed as a written answer at the end of the meeting. But we don't think that since the time guillotine, there would be no need for this procedure to then be engaged where you reach the end of the time limit, and therefore a written answer is provided instead of an oral answer. But we think it's already in the power of members opposite to say, well, look, if the minister is prepared to write to me with the answer to that question, we don't need to deal with it. I think it's useful to deal with recommendations 5 and 6 together. Recommendation 5 is as follows. We recommend that the period of notice that a member of parliament is required to give for tabling a question at a meeting should be increased from not less than 5 working days to not less than 7 working days before the day on which the answer is required. And recommendation number 6 has to be read hand in hand, because it says this. If recommendation number 5 is implemented, then we recommend that the period of notice summoning members of parliament to meetings should be increased from not less than 7 working days to not less than 9 working days before the date of the meeting. So we think these recommendations are sensible and should be accepted for a number of reasons. First of all, the earlier tabling of questions with officials in the administration who are responsible for the preparation of answers, and they do, as honourable members who've been in government offices know, have to do a lot of work in a very short period of time at the moment. In any event, Mr. Speaker, it's already possible to extend the time available to prepare an answer by simply adjourning the session in which a particular answer is due to be replied to. I can just explain that, although members of the committee understand it, but perhaps for people who may be listening in. If members have to give us those 5 days' notice, we need to come to the Parliament on the date which we've provided for. We could adjourn the Parliament at any time, even before starting questions, once we've started, or take just those questions which have their answers already prepared for, and then adjourn question time for at least another 5 days, so that the question time, or the limit for putting questions again, is not engaged, and buy ourselves another 5 or 10 or 15 days in that order. Now, that's not been done before, but in the context of wanting to make the lives of those who are doing, if I may call it, not the political work, but the grinding work that goes behind the preparation and answers to questions easier, we think that giving them the extra 2 days makes sense. And then, of course, you do need to give an extra 2 days of notice, because as the rules presently stand, if we are required to give 7 days notice, then at the moment, the answers would almost have to be put, the questions would have to be put in almost immediately. We would just take recommendation 5 and not recommendation 6. So we think that they go hand in hand together, and therefore we think it's something that should certainly be considered favourably. Again, Mr. Speaker, this 9-day period of notice, I think, makes sense for the reasons we've indicated, but also with the caveat that the Leader of the House might be able to call a House in those circumstances that I've indicated, those extraordinary meetings, on 24 hours' notice. So, if I would just pause there and take a wider view of these recommendations and your earlier recommendations in relation to the monthly meetings, I think it's not impossible for the Select Committee to come back with a mechanism that almost makes the giving of notice irrelevant, and where members know when they have to table their questions in the context of the monthly order. So, for example, we now know, and it's entrenched, that the Chief Minister will deal with questions on the third Thursday of every month at 3 p.m. That more or less sets out how the parliamentary schedule is going to play out in the context of the month. Taking part the day before as the day when Parliament will be convened for the month, it may be possible when the Select Committee meets that everybody should know that questions need to be in by the second Tuesday of the month, for example, and therefore members can, at both sides of the House, understand the order of the month and when they need to be making their arrangements to table their questions, etc., etc. Taking into consideration this idea of giving an extra 2 days and the issue of convening Parliament in 9 days, because it may be that the Select Committee can come back with a mechanism that doesn't require the Leader of the House to convene the Parliament, but that the Parliament could convene between September and April, for example, on particular months, and between April and July on particular days of the month. And that, I think, Mr. Speaker, would obviate all of these requirements as to notice. If I can move on now, Mr. Speaker, to recommendation number 7. And recommendation number 8, both of which should also be taken together, and which we have followed. We recommend that motions for adjournment should, after giving due notice to the Speaker, also be permitted to be moved at the last sitting in any month if Parliament is not to be adjourned in a year at the end of that sitting. And number 8, we recommend that both the government and opposition should bear in mind the significance of introducing motions in Parliament and thereby obtaining its approval to a specific course of action as proposed in a motion. And Mr. Speaker, we of course applaud, and I'm sure members on the other side of the House also applaud, the continued deferral of members to the motion procedure for the purposes of debating matters in this Parliament, and the fact that the Commission has also alerted us all to it. It's absolutely right that for this place to work as it should, and not as it has perhaps in the past years, we should be keeping question time as a time for questions and answers, and motion time as the time for debate. For that reason, where it's necessary for there to be an element of perhaps more agility in dealing with motions on the adjournment, we would welcome clarity in the rules so that members on both sides of the House can be clearer about the procedure and how to activate it as effectively as possible, and in that way perhaps take away some of the problems that have plagued our question time sessions. But we think that the issue of adjournment motions is already quite clear, but if this is a matter that the Select Committee can make even clearer by proposing new rules or standing orders or perhaps even just guidance notes to some of the existing standing orders, then that's something that I'm sure we welcome, no doubt, across the floor of the House, so that we perhaps better understood this procedure that seems to have fallen into disuse in recent years. Let me move now, Mr. Speaker, to recommendation number 9, which says this. We recommend that ministers should bear in mind the significance of making statements in matters of policy or public importance in Parliament in preference to making them directly to the media. And that the Speaker should be a member to put that in place. With apologies to all members, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, with respect, I think this is only a recommendation that the Commission could make in the context of the way in which we have already changed the way that Parliament works. Being under the previous mechanism for the workings of Parliament, it would have been wholly unrealistic. In fact, it would have been well nigh impossible for important statements to be made in Parliament. There were only two or three sessions of the Parliament in the year, although it was adjourned to different dates during the course of each term. But even in the context of monthly meetings of the Parliament, where we do have many more options available in terms of days when we are in the Parliament, requiring the government to, and I say requiring advisedly, to make statements of importance in the House, we don't think is possible. It may be more possible if we introduce the right of the leader of the House to convene Parliament at short notice, in 24 hours' notice. But the idea that we might be required to do that, I don't think is something that that we can agree to. Your recommendation doesn't say that. It says that we should bear in mind the significance of making statements in Parliament. And I think that is something we can certainly agree with. Although I do know that when the government decides to wait until a meeting in order to make an important announcement or table a document that doesn't strictly have to be tabled, as we have today, one does have to read some who talk about it, making a statement of importance here, then goading us in the press to make them before the date of the adjournment. And I'm reminded of the front page of yesterday's chronicle. But then again, Speaker, one gets used to the government's idea of damned if you do, damned if you don't. But this is a welcome recommendation, but it can only ever be just that, Mr. Speaker. I think I demonstrated that we do bear in mind the importance of making statements in the Parliament. But when I came here 2 weeks ago directly from the Commons, when I asked the executive to convene the coming by-election, and I made the announcement of that publicly here. But the workings of government cannot be mortgaged to the need to make statements here, and not to the press, and then to the public, in the traditional way. And then again, it represents a statement of significance. One man's significance might be another man's insignificant. So I see this recommendation that the Commission has made, Mr. Speaker, as one to bear in mind that it's a guidance that the Commission is providing, that the government should, in the words of the Commission, bear this matter in mind, but I don't think that this is a recommendation that can manifest itself in a new rule. Recommendation number 10, Mr. Speaker, the next one is also one which we don't think can become a new rule. That recommendation says this: We recommend that the more lengthy or complex bills, or those which are likely to substantially impact on citizens, should undergo in-depth legislative scrutiny by referring them to a select committee appointed for the purpose, i.e. a public bills committee. Well, as you know, Mr. Speaker, and in fact, we were one of those who negotiated it, the current constitution has introduced a 6-week period of publication for bills, which is much longer than was the case before. And in addition, since we were elected, we've also introduced a new concept, not constitutionally required, which is the principle of the command paper, which is modelled on the Westminster mechanism of the same name, and which we deploy when we're dealing with new legislative acts or changes to legislation which present a completely new area of legislation. Interestingly, both in Gibraltar and in the United Kingdom, command papers are published literally on the face of them by command of Her Majesty the Queen, but the whole purpose of the command paper and of the longer period of publication of bills is to allow a longer period of public consultation and also, of course, of interaction with members on the other side who can make not just public statements on bills, they can write to ministers or they can engage with ministers on the substance of bills. If I may say so, Mr. Speaker, although this Parliament does have a reputation for belligerent debate, I think it's fair also to say that when it comes to legislation and bills, people perhaps switch off, but there is also a tradition of working closely on bills and producing the best legislation that we can together, looking at detail, and you know, the person who's produced the bill sometimes is not able to see some of the technical issues that somebody passing a more critical eye over bills on their tradition benches might see, even some of the wording or the typographical errors, etc. And my experience has been that unless there are serious policy differences on a particular piece of legislation among members from different sides of the House, actually the bill procedure is one that works very well. The committee's recommendations in respect to this issue deal principally with a lengthy bill. We've had two or three lengthy bills in the past 4 years, which I can remember. The end of the Honourable Member's opposite tenure in government and our first 2 years. Principally the criminal offences bills and legislation. There may be soon also some companies, legislation, etc. In each of those instances, I think where we've looked at lengthy bills, we've done so in the spirit of legislative cooperation. Which is when most people switch off the listening to the Parliament, because that belligerence which people say is right, when it disappears, makes people perhaps not so interested in the process of this case. But I think that process, therefore, of working closely together on bills is there. There is, I understand, already some power to refer bills to a committee, not just to the committee stage, and perhaps it's something that we need to revise rather than produce a new rule on, because we think that the process is actually working quite well. Mr. Speaker, the 11th recommendation reads as follows. We recommend that the Gibraltar Constitution Order 2006 should be amended to provide for the post of Deputy Speaker, and that until there is constitutional provision for such an appointment, the Parliament should designate a suitably qualified person to discharge all or some of the powers and functions imposed on the Speaker when he or she is unable to attend meetings of Parliament. Such a person should be selected by Parliament in the same manner as the Speaker. So, Mr. Speaker, we actually wholeheartedly agree with the sentiments in respect of the post of Deputy Speaker. But our initial conclusion is that it would appear to be very difficult to create this post other than by constitutional amendment, as you indicated in the recommendation. But this is one of the most practical recommendations, in our view, that the Commission makes, because it's about actually Parliament being able to work, and we need a speaker to be able to work. We therefore support this recommendation, and we consider it should be referred to the Select Committee in order to enable the committee to better consider how the issue constitutional amendment. Frankly, I think that this was an issue that has been overlooked at the time that we were negotiating the new constitution. It wasn't something that was there before. We didn't have monthly meetings of the parliament at the time of the constitution that was being negotiated, so therefore I think it's something that in the context of the new rhythm of parliamentary meetings does have to be considered. Of course, the Speaker, there is provision in the absence of the Speaker for a member to be elevated to the chair. In a particularly acrimonious debate, who could that member be? I mean, two spring to mind immediately. The father of the house, who's been here for longer than all of the rest of us, absent itself, or the other longest serving member, the Honourable, the previous Chief Minister, backbencher, Mr. Kahana. But I don't discard Mr. Speaker that the Parliament would, in appropriate circumstances, appoint each or either of them to the role. I think it would be hard for each of them, for example, to preside over a budget debate in the event that it were necessary for you to absent yourself from such a debate in extremis. But not impossible. I think both have had the longevity in this Parliament to understand what the rules of this Parliament are and to adjudicate fairly in the context of parliamentary obligations when one takes that chair. Would it be in the context of an acrimonious debate like the debate on the appropriation bill sometimes becomes something that could be done in a way that all parties would feel that they have been fairly dealt with if that person had to make a ruling against their own side, if he's doing it just to demonstrate that he is being fair, or against the opposite side. Of course, he'd do that, wouldn't he? And I think, therefore, that there are some circumstances in extremis where we might find ourselves in difficulty without wishing to impugn the integrity of those who might take the chair. And I've mentioned who, if they took the chair, in my view, would be able to discharge their obligations and that chair with integrity. But it would perhaps raise in the public concern if there did come a time, an acrimonious moment, and they did have to make rulings one way or the other. And therefore, the mechanism of a deputy speaker in a parliament that meets monthly, I think, is one that does need to be considered by the select committee. The Speaker recommendations 12 and 13, I think, should also be taken together. They read follows. 12 says this. We recommend that there should be a review of the present structure of allowances and pensions payable to members of Parliament, and that such a review should be conducted by a body made up of suitably qualified persons from Gibraltar and persons from an appropriate independent authority from the United Kingdom. Number 13 says this. We recommend that any new pension scheme should come into effect for new members of Parliament elected after the next general election, thereby safeguarding the acquired rights of current members. For the Speaker, we think that taken together, we agree with both those recommendations, given that having this Parliament, in effect, having made changes, for example, to the civil service final salary pension scheme, it would be rather unfair not to also look at what new scheme might be introduced for members who might be elected after the next general election. This is certainly something in our view that should be referred to the select committee for it to determine who should best advise us on the matter. Our own initial view is that new members of the Parliament after the next general election should be on the same scheme, I think it's the Providence scheme, as new entrants to the civil service, for example. That seems fair and equitable to us, but we agree that this should be considered objectively with independent persons, as was previously the case when the allowances were reviewed in the 1970s. And advised, I think, because the present scheme for current members does not allow existing members who have something similar to the civil service final salary scheme to have a WACC element to their contribution. And in that sense, the existing scheme is less generous than the final salary scheme. But again, I think that this is not an issue for us. I think it's an issue that should be considered by independent officials appointed by the select committee. I move then, Mr. Speaker, to recommendations 14 and 15. These say the following, and I should also take them together. In fact, 14 and 15 and 16, I think, are usefully taken together. They read as follows. 14, we recommend that the rules in the Declaration of Members' Interest should be reviewed by a body made up of at least three suitably qualified persons from Gibraltar, one of whom should be as the chairperson, and a person from an appropriate, independent authority for the United Kingdom with experience in this kind of exercise. We also recommend that the Register of Members' Interest should be made available on the Parliament's website. We recommend that the Parliamentary Code, this is 15, applicable to all members of Parliament should be drafted by the same person as specified in Recommendation 14, and that the Parliament should determine its introduction by resolution. And in 16, we recommend that a review of the Ministerial Code should be conducted by a body of at least three suitably qualified persons in Gibraltar, that the code should be drawn up along the lines of that applicable to ministers in the United Kingdom, and that it should be kept under periodical review. Mr. Speaker, we agree wholeheartedly with these recommendations. A draft is already being considered by ministers of both the rules on declaration of interest as well as the code of conduct for both parliamentarians generally and for ministers specifically. And I think that this is absolutely an issue to be referred to the select committee, as well as the drafts that are already in existence of the new rules and the code for the committee, to reach conclusions and to make recommendations for the implementation of the new code. I think we've said already, and the next members should know, that we've worked with the Hansard Society in the United Kingdom to look at the detail of the code, and in fact one of the members of the commission has been involved in that. I especially think, Mr. Speaker, that there should be a mechanism to review such documents as are adopted and as are put in place, so that they are the living documents that don't just fall into dispute and become irrelevant by the passage of time, never consulted by members. Because when that happens, you know, there is, I think, a loss to the community as a whole and a loss of the Parliament. If we just create rules and then put them in the cupboard, I don't think that that is an appropriate way of really bringing new scriptures to the Parliament and to its members. I think it's something that should be adopted, but with a periodic review procedure so that they are continually looked at. The next recommendation is one which I think is no longer as controversial as it once was, although some members have been against it completely before, as they joined in. Mr. Kavanagh candidly reminded us at the penultimate meeting of the House, but I think that we are now of the same view. And that's recommendation 17, which says this: we recommend that consideration should be given to televising the proceedings of Parliament, and we further recommend that in the event of a privatisation of the Gibraltar Broadcasting Corporation, the arrangement for the televising of parliamentary proceedings should be guaranteed. I don't think there is any privatisation of the Gibraltar Broadcasting Corporation ever envisaged, but I think it's important that the committee's recommendations should certainly be adopted. The House has already had an opportunity to consider this issue at the last meeting before the refurbishment, and I think we've now clearly got a majority, if not unanimity, supporting video broadcasting online and on television. And we just now need to look at the relevant rules. And this is what I understand, Mr. Speaker, that the Deputy thinks the risk of sent a legal resolution and the arguments for the female, some draft rules for consideration as we transmission, camera rules, etc. They're not complicated rules, and we have some guidance already from Westminster in how they successfully done this, and I know that the testing that is going on behind your chair of the equipment is being quite successful, so I hope that we'll be able to agree the rules shortly, and that we'll be ready to submit, as I've said on a number of occasions, by the time we come to the situation of the appropriation bill later on this month. Mr. Speaker, recommendation 18 also deals with media issues, if of a slightly different type. So We recommend that the media director should henceforth be required to prepare and publish an annual report on the activities of his department, which should include a detailed statement listing the recipients of the amount of public funds paid to the media. We further recommend that this report should be laid on the table in Parliament. Further, Mr. Speaker, we wholeheartedly agree with the principle that the detailed statement of the amount of public funds paid to the media should be published. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, we believe that we've led on this issue, given it was one of the issues we continually were obligated to ask about in Parliament. You'll recall, Mr. Speaker, that we had very clear issues relating to the presently defunct publication, The 7 Days, and the huge amounts expended on it by the previous administration. For that reason, Mr. Speaker, we take the view that the precise amount paid in respect of government advertising since the very date of our election should have been and are, as I understand it, published online regularly and accessible to the public as a whole, and not just to members of Parliament. But we don't necessarily think that getting the media director to collate that information into an annual report, because it's already shown with annual totals, etc., online, would add much to the equation. We think we've gone further by putting it out into the public domain with regularity. So we think that this is a recommendation that's already been complied with in substance, of the information is there, and that we don't need to go further. Recommendation 19 then moves to deal with a wholly different matter, which is the manner for convening a select committee's journey. It says here, Mr. Speaker, we recommend that Parliament should make greater use of standing orders to nominate select committees where appropriate. Again, Mr. Speaker, I don't think that this is intended as a recommendation which requires action or a new rule, but it's one which the Commission, I think, wants the Parliament to know. Well, indeed, Mr. Speaker, you know that during the course of this debate, I've already proposed creating this bespoke select committee to deal with the very reform proposals that we're considering. I don't know that we can go any further in that respect, because a recommendation to know it's something that there's already a rule for, I think doesn't call for much more other than for members on both sides to bear in mind those issues when considering how best to regulate our procedures in respect of particular debate bills or anything that may require our parliamentary attention. Recommendation number 20, Mr. Speaker, deals with the present system of dealing with petitions and the way it should be modernised. It says this: we recommend that standing orders should be revised to improve the public petition system as a way of enhancing public participation in the parliamentary process along the lines of the system in the United Kingdom. Well, I think, Mr. Speaker, this is one to carefully consider in committee. Conscious of the fact that there are already rules allowing petitions to be tabled here and debated. All that's required is to give a petition to be put to the Parliament. It's then tabled. And it only takes one member to raise a motion in the terms of the petition for the matter to be debated. So, again, this may be, and this is not so much where we need to change our rules, but where a rule has fallen into disuse and we need to refresh it. It may be that it needs to be modernised. There have been some changes in the United Kingdom. There are some online petition issues. And I think it's something that the Select Committee should look at, and that perhaps the public need to be made more aware of, so that they can become more involved in the workings of this Parliament by making use of the existing or modernised petition rules. Certainly something that we think should be put to the Select Committee for the Select Committee to consider side by side with the more modern rules that have now been adopted in other parliaments. If you think of the report that is behind matters dealing with what I might call the inner workings of the Parliament and rules on the issues relating really to the electoral system. So I'm going to deal with the recommendations that you make in that respect, also on a detailed basis, taking each of them in turn.
The first specifically addresses the establishment of the franchise, who is entitled to vote and the creation of the register of electors. Recommendation 21 says this: we recommend that a rolling register should be maintained for Gibraltar parliamentary elections on the lines of that maintained for European parliamentary elections. Speaker, this is absolutely something with which we entirely agree, and it is our policy on this side of the House that that should be the case. We think that the present system is not the fairest, and we should have a permanently open register which closes a fixed time before an election, rather than a register that is sometimes open when an election is called. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, if that were already the case, this by-election, which has been convened, would have benefited from a slightly wider franchise. We're therefore convinced, Mr. Speaker, that this is the way to progress, but with an important caveat. And that is, compiling of registers of electors is not an easy task. It's complex, and it requires understanding the issues that can arise. If I'm faithful, the present clerk and the returning officer has considerable experience and expertise in this field, and I think he should be the leading resource for the select committee to consult when considering this issue in particular, as if he didn't have enough work. And we're lucky enough that our clerk maintains both the register of electors for national elections and the European elections register, which I understand is open on a rolling basis. So you've got experience of both types of registers. And I think it's important that we don't turn our back on that important resource when we're considering how to change our register of electors rules. The next issue, Mr. Speaker, deals with election expenses. This is recommendation 22. We recommend that section 14(2) of the Parliament Act should be revoked and that all election expenses incurred at any time before the date of the poll should be taken into account to arrive at the total amount of election expenses incurred. Well, this is a difficult issue, but it's important that election expenses rules are there, are workable, and are observed, because they are what guarantee the level playing field beyond which parties cannot spend, however passive one party may be compared to another. But to understand the recommendation, I think we've got to look at section 14(2) of the Act, which we follow. In determining the total expenditure incurred in relation to the candidature of any person at any election, regard shall not be had to any expenditure incurred 1 month or more before the election in respect of services rendered or materials supplied. What that section is trying to do, Mr. Speaker, the whole purpose of the clause is to ensure that the party that knows the date of the election cannot spend before the election without there being at least a hiatus in their pre-election spending. Members will no doubt recall, Mr. Speaker, before the last election, a glossy booklet delivered to all households in Gibraltar, which was distributed, I don't know whether almost exactly or just beyond the 30-day limit before the start of the last campaign. Members of it, well, that's the part. We probably look forward. And we agree that section 14(2) is outmoded and it's not necessarily working as it was intended to work, but it needs to be addressed. But having said that, Mr. Speaker, the recommendation we think goes a bit too far, because simply abolishing the time limit may not have the desired effect. And that's what the recommendation says, abolish the time limit. And if you did that, Mr. Speaker, then you would be left in a situation where all expenditure in the 4 years, in the 4 year term, would be relevant. In fact, if you get rid of the time limit, why just limit it to the 4 year term? And how far back do you go? So, your 14(2) has not perhaps worked in exactly the right way, and we need to address the concerns clearly expressed by the Commission in the Select Committee to see what change 14(2) may have to undergo. But I don't think that getting rid of the time limit is necessarily the way that we deal or cure the problem. Equally agreeable as to purpose, the speaker, and perhaps less problematic in implementation, is the recommendation at number 23, which says this. We recommend that the election rules should provide, by means of a schedule, the format of the return of election expenses and the form of words of the statutory declaration. Well, Mr. Speaker, we certainly agree with the Commission that the practice is built up of each party, in the absence of any rules, presenting accounts in their own format, as they see fit, in keeping with general accounting principles or whatever it is, that the returning officer and even members of the public that they want to inspect the election expenses are looking at things which are not compiled in the same way, or therefore not necessarily comparing right with right. And those formats, in fact, probably just a form, not so much a format, a form, which the returning officer produces to each party for them to account for expenses in a particular format, so that everybody who then has an interest in looking at these expenses can see the same form filed by each party, or by each candidate, rather, I think is something which should not necessarily be resisted. I think it's something that the Select Committee will want to look at and can produce a form in which relevant election agents can report expenditure in an equal way. The next recommendation, Mr. Speaker, deals with inspection of the return for election expenses. And it says this: we recommend that Section 15 of the Parliament Act should specify that the return to election expenses can be available for public inspection without limitation. But if you need to put that recommendation in context, Section 15.5, which is a relevant part of Section 15 of the Parliament Act, deals with publication of election expenses like this. It says the returning officer, within 10 days after he receives any return under this section, shall publish in a daily newspaper a notice of the time and place at which the return and the document of support thereof can be inspected. So, we're going to have a number of issues. Different parties or different candidates may put in returns at different dates. I think that the practice of the returning officer will be to set a window when they have to be submitted, otherwise we might have to be advertising, you know, for candidate X, you can come and see on this day, for candidate Y, you can come and see on that day, because of the 10-day limit that operates on him. But what we don't think this section does is limit how long election expense documentation is available for inspection, although it may have been traditionally interpreted in that way. So this is a recommendation that the Commission makes that we agree should be referred to the Select Committee, even if only to clarify that the returning officer is free to designate, although we think he already is, but just to clarify that the time and place for inspection could be as wide, for example, as at Parliament House on any day until the date that the next election is convened, for example, which would in effect allow the documents to be inspected throughout the lifetime of the relevant parliament, or perhaps even longer if you wanted to use different language and wanted to have this as a public record that is just publicly available for anybody to inspect. And frankly, in our view, Mr. Speaker, this is not information that should be published online and should be available for any citizen who wants to inspect it, like all other parliamentary information like the Registry of Members' Interest, which the Commission has recommended to also be online, and we agree. But if there are ambiguities that have led returning officers to think that they make this information available only for a specific time, in a specific place, if the internet has overtaken us all and we need to provide new wording, then I think this is something that the Select Committee can look at and resolve quite quickly. Mr. Speaker, the next recommendation deals with contributions to candidates' election expenses during the course of election campaigns. It's recommendation 25, and it reads as follows. We recommend that every donation over £100 incidental to an election campaign, whether as one donation or as several lesser donations amounting in total to £100 from the same source, should be separately declared in the return of election expenses
together with the identity of the donor. On Speaker, we agree that the candidate's return of election expenses or the return of a group of candidates should certainly illustrate who has contributed to the campaign of that candidate. Multiples of £100 doesn't seem an unfair amount to be referring to, although the select committee may think that a slightly larger amount, like £250 maybe relevant. And we agree that this recommendation of the candidate's election expenses should be referred to the select committee for implementation at the next general election. The next recommendation, Mr. Speaker, then deals with what is an election expense. And it says this: we recommend that the Parliament Act should provide an extensive definition of election expenses. Well, for the reasons that have been identified in the report, Mr. Speaker, we need to give some meaning to the rules on spending, and we agree. And the Select Committee, I think, will need to come up with a definition, probably not exactly reinvent the wheel. There may be definitions used in other parliaments that we can cannibalize for our purposes. Checking the Parliament Act, it's clear that there is nothing there which assists in the definition of an election expense. One would have expected that the Act would contain a definition of election expense. It's not there, that definition, and perhaps it needs to be there or elsewhere in the rule. But I think it's also fair to say that in the context of the recommendations that we make, I think there are three areas where the Parliament Act, it is recommended by the Commission, that should be amended. It's a piece of legislation from 1950, and those who go online now can see how often it's been amended. It's only been amended 5 or 6 times in the past 63 years. I think that demonstrates that a good piece of legislation, which has worked well, but that now requires tweaking, and that we shouldn't be shy in the Select Committee of making such recommendations for amendment of it as may be necessary in order to update it into the more modern practices that have now overtaken the way in which elections are run. Well, the Speaker, the Commission then moves on to recommendations that deal with the vote and voting. Recommendations for the 728 and 29, which are dealt with together, say as follows. We recommend that early absentee voting should be introduced for electors who satisfy the returning officer that they are obliged to be absent from Gibraltar at short notice on polling day for unforeseeable and compelling reasons and cannot report to postal voting. I recall, Mr. Speaker, I think in the last two elections, there have been a number of pilgrimages organised around the date of the poll, involving supporting all those candidates, and that and other reasons for being anti Gibraltar have led to an ad hoc procedure being set up in some instances. Recommendation 28 then says we recommend that section 22 of the Parliament Act should be amended to increase the period between the issue of a writ calling for a general election and the day of the election from not less than 30 days to not less than 42 days. And recommendation 29 says that we recommend that the timetable in Rule 2 of the election rules should be amended to set the closing date for the delivery of nomination papers as noon on the 43rd day before the date of the election instead of the present 21st day, and additionally consequential adjustments should be made in the period of time allowed candidates to withdraw their candidature. Well, Mr. Speaker, we certainly agree with recommendation 27 on early absentee voting, but subject to a mechanism, and I'm sure that this is what the Select Committee will want to ensure, being introduced and implemented in the Parliament, which is in this building itself, in other words, in the control and under the auspices of the returning officer, and with appropriate security mechanisms in place. As we all know who've been involved in elections, Mr. Speaker, this place becomes a hive of activity at the time of a general election. It is also the most secure place where ballot papers, etc., are held and delivered. Bringing people in to vote will have an effect on the workings of the returning officer at the time, but of course, in the context of other changes, like, for example, the register of electors being open and closing just after an election is called, rather than to wait for huge work from the returning officer at the time. And we could instead have this process of having absentee voting going on in the parliament in a way that doesn't upset the working of the returning officer. I know it's been done before, it's just a question of agreeing the mechanism. All parties have been happy with it. The security of it, the integrity of the vote is not in any way questioned, also being dealt with, and one that I'm sure will enjoy support across the floor of the House. We also agree with the Speaker in relation to recommendations 28 and 29 that the time limits for elections have been too short in the past, in particular because of the complication of supplementary registers of electors being compiled sometimes at the same time. So, again, in the context of an open register, although these issues should be less relevant in the future, and time may not be at such a premium, I think it's still going to be a busy time for the returning officer and the staff, as well as for candidates and party workers. So therefore, we would agree the extension of these relevant time limits, but perhaps the Speaker not to the extent proposed by the Commission. So in Recommendation 28, we propose that Section 28 of the Parliament Act be amended to not less than 35 days, so 5 more days than the current 30 days, but 7 less than the proposed 42. And in respect of Recommendation 29, instead of increasing the time in Rule 2 of the election rules from 21 days to 33 days, which we think would be slightly too long, we would propose also a time of 28 days. But that is detail, Mr. Speaker, and we're happy to consider that detail with colleagues in the context of the work of the Select Committee and with the returning officer who has the experience of what it is that goes on at the time of the election is called. Mr. Speaker, the recommendation number 30, we think, has actually now been overtaken by events. That recommendation states follows: we recommend that the Gibraltar Regulatory Authority should set a code of broadcasting standards for Gibraltar parliamentary elections in consultation with the returning officer and the Gibraltar Broadcasting Corporation, in line with the requirements of the European Parliamentary Elections Act. So, Mr. Speaker, as you're aware, the Broadcasting Act 2012 does just that. But in fact, it's for that reason that we've recently argued in press releases that the composition of the board of GBC, for example, is no longer relevant in relation to balance and appeal to editorial decisions. But in any event, this is a recommendation that is happily one that we take view has already been specifically implemented in almost identical terms to the recommendation of the Commission. Still on the media at the time of the election, recommendation 31 is this: we recommend that exit polls should be regulated as to the manner in which they are conducted and that a prohibition should be placed in publication of their results prior to the end of voting on polling day. This is already the case by established convention in our understanding. But it's interesting that there isn't, or there hasn't traditionally been, a legal rule that provides for this. I don't know whether the regulator may have in the rules he's made now dealt with this issue. But it's certainly in our view something for the Select Committee to consider, because if there isn't already a rule, there certainly should be a rule that exit polls should not be published, or polls should not be published during polling day. I don't think it's a rule that also mentioned has ever been breached in Gibraltar, but perhaps it's important that we now have this rule. And the one thing you see that I would say in respect of your of these sorry, recommendations 30 and 31 that I've just dealt with, Mr. Speaker, is that of course it's very easy to regulate those that cannot escape regulation, like for example the BBC and the rules that the GRA makes have to be observed by the BBC as a public broadcaster. Conceivably any other broadcaster licensed in Gibraltar is caught by the regulation of the regulatory authority subject to the recommendation that we've made, of course. But how do you regulate the internet? That's an issue that goes beyond this debate, of course, but it would be a relevant factor. Who has the power to regulate what is put up on social media or on internet sites, the domains of which are hosted outside of Gibraltar? That's an issue that I think perhaps the Select Committee will need to consider in the context of this business of exit polls, etc., because absent people voluntarily adhering to the conventions that have been followed in the past, it may not be that there is a regulator with reach like the GRA that reaches other broadcasters in the election. It may be that the returning officer who has responsibility for elections is the right person to regulate some aspects of this in the, if I may call them, the sort of disestablished media. And there should be general rules which can catch people in Gibraltar under the powers that the returning officer has. Again, something that the committee will have to consider in greater detail. Speaker, the report will move on really to the night of the count. I'm making this recommendation as recommendation 32. We recommend that the returning officer should give serious consideration to establishing what technological advances are available for the counting of votes and whether these could be adopted in Gibraltar. Anybody who went through the last night, Mr. Speaker, would have been very happy to see a computer telling the result by 1 in the morning. But anyway, we agree that new technologies should be considered, but always subject to the integrity of the counting process and of the vote being guaranteed. It has always been guaranteed in Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, even though we've taken a few hours, 5-6 hours to count, we've known that we can count on the integrity of those involved in counting on the night, and that we get a very precise and very clear result. I mean, I think nobody in this House would want the nightmare of panning tabs that we all have to become very interested in the early part of the last decade, handing over an election result in Gibraltar with our Supreme Court being involved in determining issues and there not being a result announced. When you implement a system that's designed to give you a sooner result. So I think something to look at, something for the Select Committee to work on. Again, I think with the members of the House staff and the returning officer. Mr. Speaker, in recommendation 33, the Commission deals with a proposal to create a register of political parties. And you also, outside the recommendation, deal with what political parties should do and how they should run their affairs and all the rest of it. The recommendation alone says this. We recommend that the scheduling legislation for the registration of political parties, with the basic provisions detailed in the outline proposal of Appendix 1, should be introduced. And in doing so, you introduce Appendix 1 into the recommendation. So if I can just take members of the House to it. Appendix 1 sets out the proposal for registration of political parties, setting out that they must have a constitution, what the objective is made up of, subscriptions, annual general meetings, etc. I think we must not part company with the Commission on this issue. We don't believe there should be a requirement of registration for political parties. The constitutional freedom of association in our constitution, in our view, requires that people should be able to congregate without the requirement to register as political parties. The same is true, you might say, Mr. Speaker, in respect of trade unions, and yet trade unions are required to register themselves. But trade unions enjoy immunity under our laws for specific purposes. And therefore, the registration engages those immunities. Political parties actually don't enjoy advantages. It's actually members of parliament that enjoy advantages, and they congregate in groups that they call political parties. But we don't think that it is constitutionally acceptable to require people to register themselves as political parties. If I may, just Mr. Speaker, without entering into the politics of it, I know that members of it, in their political party, run things or have run things in the past in a different way. Look, it's worked for them. And people have accepted that and returned them as a parliamentary group to the government benches on a number of occasions. When the Honourable, now Deputy Chief Minister, and Mr. Messina and I were much younger, we congregated around the coffee table and called ourselves a political party, and what's wrong with that? And should we be required to register and to hold meetings in a particular way? And should any strictures be put in the way that people organise themselves as a political party? I mean, one wonders what the anarchist party might think of that, and they have a right also to regulate their own affairs in such way as they may on each day decide. Just an aside, I think that this could interfere with the right to congregate and associate freely under the Constitution, and therefore that recommendation won't enjoy the support of those up in the government benches. Neither, Mr. Speaker, do we need to see a need for the establishment of a statutory election commission, as recommended in Recommendation 34, which reads as follows. We recommend that the introduction of a bill for the establishment of a statutory body should be known as the Electoral Commission, with the basic provisions detailed in the outline proposal of Appendix 2. Appendix 2, Mr. Speaker, to the Commission report is almost, I must say, a very full proposal for a bill with quite a lot of detail, and I'm sorry to say, because a lot of work has obviously been done by the Commission on that, but we don't think that the Electoral Commission is relevant in Gibraltar. I don't think anybody's ever questioned the integrity of the way that we conduct elections. We are a thriving democracy. It may be rougher or tougher during different parts of the election campaign, but I think that this Parliament has demonstrated that it is elected fairly and freely, successfully. There's been transfers of power now on a number of occasions in Gibraltar. To such an extent, I think we can call ourselves a mature democracy. Now, the Electoral Commission might actually be an indicator of maturity in other parliaments and other democracies. We just don't think it's something which is necessary in Gibraltar because of the mechanisms that we have in place and the control that's in place already through the Office of the Returning Officer and the powers contained in the Parliament Act. In particular, if we make amendments to the Parliament Act and we give powers to the Returning Officer in the context of what the Commission is going to consider. We'll hear what members of the have to say about that, but we are not convinced that this is something that requires engagement. We're with you, though, Mr. Speaker, and with the Commission, Mr. Speaker, on Recommendation 35, which states this. We recommend that legislation permitting the holding of and regulating the conduct of referendum should be enacted. Referenda should be enacted. Well, that's been our policy. I think Mr. Peter Haynes said that our 2003 referendum was not valid. Indeed, I think there is already a draft bill that will shortly be published to deal with this issue. And I think we also have you here that there still was power to convene a referendum. But ex abundante cancella, one not have a piece of legislation that now sets out what the requirements and what the mechanisms for future referenda might be. And then, Mr. Speaker, the Commission moves on hand in hand with all of these issues. How should the franchise be conducted and who should be a part of it? And Recommendation 36 says this. We recommend that the Parliament Act should be amended to increase qualifying residency period from a continuous period of 6 months to a continuous period of 3 years. We think that's a sensible recommendation, but we think it's something that needs to be considered, and the implications of it need to be considered in detail by the select committee. And I think there will be people who will have been here for more than 6 months before the rules change, who might say that they acquired rights should an election be called after that period, but before they're here for 3 years. So I think this is an issue that needs to be considered in detail by the select committee. Although I think it's likely that most of us agree that a residence period of 6 months is probably 96, for people to know what it is that they're voting on or about and what the parties are. But I think it's one matter that
before determining how to accept that recommendation and what the exact time limit should be. We don't agree, Mr. Speaker, however, with the 37th recommendation of the Select Committee, which is this. We recommend that the Parliament Act should be amended to extend the franchise to persons residing outside the border who are 18 years or over, who are registered with Gibraltar and under the Gibraltar in the state of that, and who are A, in permanent employment, B, actively involved in carrying on a business, C, exercising their profession, or D, in full-time education in Gibraltar. But this is not an issue that has an easy solution. May I say that I think that people who are in full-time education outside of Gibraltar are already entitled to vote in Gibraltar elections. Hence, that we have at Gibraltar House in London, usually, a polling station, so to speak, for ballots to be sent in as close to ballots around here to Gibraltar. Some of them can be sent directly to Gibraltar. So, B in 37, we believe, is already covered. Now, the other issue is that people have moved out of Gibraltar, they're literally living out of Gibraltar, not for education purposes. And they have traditionally and historically foregone their right to vote, because it's always been a right based on residence. So, to make the issue of the right to register based on the other three limits of 37 and registration under the Gibraltarian status is, we think, a little bit too complicated and perhaps not quite as fair as it may seem at first glance. For example, somebody may be entitled to register under the Gibraltarian status act even though they've only been here 3 years, but they may, for other reasons, be entitled to register. Then if they maintain a company in Gibraltar through which they do their business, they could go and live anywhere else in the world and be entitled to vote. And if you could have people who've been resident in Gibraltar all of their lives, but are not able to register under the Gibraltarian Status Act for some other reason, there are instances that come to me, as I'm sure they came to the previous Chief Minister, people, for example, who've been resident in Gibraltar for 15 years, have gone to the United Kingdom, and they're back after 8 years and they want to register under the Gibraltarian Status Act. And they're not able to because they don't have the lineage and they have issues and they would have had their residence for 25 years coming up. Or there are circumstances like that which create unfairness. And but the traditional way of determining who is entitled to vote in our parliamentary elections has been based on residence. We don't think that that is an unfair way of determining who is entitled to vote in the future. And we would therefore propose to continue to be based, the franchise to continue to be based on residence as it historically has been, with the caveat that we do think that Gibraltarians who are studying abroad should be entitled to vote, but we think that is the case already and that no amendment is required for that purpose. And certainly, Mr. Speaker, unless I'm wrong, in every election in which I've been involved since 2003, those who have been studying in the United Kingdom, Gibraltar students in the United Kingdom, have been able to vote as postal voters. And facilities have been put in place to try and ensure that the postal voting mechanism has not thwarted their ability to have their vote counted by allowing for that to be sent right to the moment to go to Gibraltar House. Mr. Speaker, then recommendation 38 is this. We recommend that the maximum period of time between the issue of a writ and the holding of a general election should be reduced from 3 months to 42 days. We think that there are very few circumstances where this would be relevant, but we think that limiting to the period in this case is not hugely important. We're not persuaded that there are good reasons to amend the Constitution, and this would require a constitutional amendment to make this change, although it may be something that if there are constitutional revisions in the future could then be considered in more detail. But if a Chief Minister wants to call an election in 42 days' time, he can. If he wants to call it in 30 days' time, he can, subject to the new limits that we're thinking of putting in, or that's 35. if he wants to give 3 months' notice, well, I mean, that's a bad thing for others who are going to be involved in the election because they're in there for longer. I wager people will get bored of us politicians running around campaigning for a whole 3 months, but it wouldn't be bad for democracy. So when would this period be relevant? It would probably be relevant when time has run out for an election to be called, and it's called automatically, and it's then called for 3 months' event, rather than 42 days' event, which is what is being proposed. I don't think it's a hugely important issue. Americans have an engagement and amendment of the Constitution. It may be something that, if there are constitutional reports going on, it can be looked at, but we don't think that it would hugely enhance the quality of our democracy to engage just for that purpose. Finally, to speak of the 39th recommendation refers to offices for the leader and members of the opposition and leader follows. They recommend that office and secretarial facilities for the leader and members of the opposition should be made available near the parliament. We don't believe that Speaker that services should be provided to opposition members alone. Government members do work as government ministers, but they also do work as members of the House. The refurbishment of the Parliament is already underway, beyond the refurbishment of this chamber, and we'll shortly move to a refurbishment of the antechamber and other parts around the building, but truly now we make it possible to create new spaces for members generally, not just members of the opposition, but members generally, to have available the meeting rooms that the Commission recommends with some appropriate secretarial support. So I think that speaks for.
I hope we keep him strong enough to go to the Speaker.
Carries the thought of the Speaker. In fact, as it happens, I think you're the only person that has an office at the moment, but the whole idea of the refurbishment is the refurbishment of the whole of the area at the back and perhaps some of the other areas in and around the building, and certainly Mr. Speaker would not be forgotten in this context. The ability to do the business of Parliament as parliamentarians must depend on having the facilities necessary for us to do that work as parliamentarians. That includes the Speaker, the clerk and officers of the House, as well as members on both sides of the House. But if I may just say, Mr. Speaker, in the context of the assistance that members of the staff of the House give members of the Parliament, certainly in my experience when in opposition was that they were hugely helpful whenever they could. Of course, in the context of an election campaign, there's a lot going on, and the members of the House staff become the returning officers' staff, and we can't expect at that time to ask for a copy of the relevant homicide and get it as quickly as we might on a quiet day in beat of August when there isn't an election campaign going on. But absent that, and I found, as I'm sure members across the floor have found, that a member of staff of the House are hugely helpful, whether one is in government or in opposition. They are blind to their members' sit. We are all just members of five second friends, but with our different responsibilities, and hugely helpful at that. Mr. Speaker, I dealt specifically, as I set out to do, with the Commission's recommendations only, because that, in my view, is what the Commission is putting to the Parliament. I've not dealt with matters on which we've not made recommendations. In particular, Mr. Speaker, I note the dissenting opinion that the Commission has provided from Mr. Vasco's issue. You've not made a recommendation in respect of the views advanced by him, so I've not had to address it. But we take careful note of what he writes. There's no recommendation there, though, for us to consider. Mr. Speaker, the Select Committee that I propose to establish, to look at the detail, will need the help and support, as I've said, also the clerk. But I believe it could also need at least one with the whole Commission to go through some of the areas that I think should be deferred to the Select Committee, so that to have some conversation, we could hear the voice of the Commission and what their concerns were, in case we may have misinterpreted any of them. I'm conscious of the fact that although you were the chairman of it, you cannot have your chair for part of this debate, and therefore I think the appropriate process would be for the Select Committee to engage with the whole Committee at the start of its work, so that the Commission can inform the committee of any aspect of its work that may be relevant.
But Speaker, finally, I'd say that I think I've structured my intervention today in a recommendation, or by recommendation, based on the position that is clear to honourable members on both sides on each. And I very much look forward to hearing what it is that members opposite have to say. And I would alert the House, Mr. Speaker, that my intention would be to hear what other members have to say and then recess for a short while so that we can, if necessary, consider issues together as to the amendment and then come back and take the amendment during the course of my reply. As I said, I hope that we can have this debate in the spirit of cooperation and not of confrontation, because I think that reforming the Parliament and reforming its procedures is improving our democracy for the better. That's what our citizens demand and deserve. Mr. Speaker, at that moment, conscious of the fact that I've been on my feet for quite a while, can I propose that we recess now also for a few minutes in case members need to have a comfort break or something? I would like to be in the chamber for the whole of the debate and wouldn't mind a recess of 5 minutes of your review.
The House will now have a short recess of 10 minutes. I now propose a question in the terms of the motion moved by the Honourable Chief Minister. Is any honourable member wish to speak?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. First of all, may I start by thanking the Commission and you in particular for the report and the obvious time, effort, and care that the entirety of the Commission has taken in producing this report. And obviously, I speak on behalf of all honourable members on this side of the House. And Mr. Speaker, in relation to the mechanics, I want you to say something about the mechanics that the Chief Minister outlined at the beginning of his intervention in relation to this debate. The Chief Minister and I have already spoken in the anteroom, and what I will do is I'll allow the Chief Minister to basically, by way of response, to deal with the question of mechanics, because I understand that you've agreed in principle to move away from what was originally proposed, which was for the motion to be amended in order to include all the recommendations that the government thinks it ought to include in that motion, to a different suggestion that allow the Chief Minister to effectively outline to this House and indeed to listen it out there what we tentatively agreed. Mr. Speaker, I'm going to be effectively talking about general principles. I'm going to be focusing on a number of areas. Before I outline those areas, all the honourable members on this side of the House will have an opportunity and indeed will speak on the report. Isabella Lewis Hammond will be talking about Part 2, although I will be dealing with definition in relation to Part 2. Mr. Bosina will be talking about Part 3. Edwin Zedders will be talking about Part 4. And Mr. Neto will be talking about something that is dear to his own heart. He talks from his own perspective, his own view, and that is in relation to the oath that we all have to swear at the beginning of parliamentary proceedings. But Mr. Speaker, in my own intervention, what I want to talk about is, first of all, I'd like to place
this report and indeed the debate on parliamentary reform to its proper historical context. I think that's helpful and that's what I intend to do. Secondly, it's the issue of enlargement, which is of fundamental importance to this side of the House. Thirdly, a question and answer. Fourth, parliamentary timetable. And then finally, I'll talk from a personal perspective, Mr. Speaker, because it's not an issue that, in fact, my party has a particular policy of outline, but from a personal perspective, I want to talk about something that doesn't contain a recommendation, but it is dealt with by the report, and that is the serving for nobody to be served as chief minister for more than 2 terms. Mr. Speaker, you can see from the outline of these 5 points that, in fact, I'm not going to be restricting myself to the recommendations made by the Commission, indeed. I'm going to be talking about areas where there is no recommendation by the Commission, but that are, as I say, that are largely important to this party on this side of the House. Mr. Speaker, parliamentary modernisation was always envisioned at some point in the future when we negotiated a new constitution. In 2007, we moved to a constitution which not only, in our view, provides a maximum level of state government, but included, amongst other things, that modernisation of the composition of this parliament and indeed the balance of executive competences. The Financial Development Secretary and the Attorney General were replaced by elected members, and I have the privilege of being the First Minister for Justice to swear an oath at the opening of Parliament after the 2007 election, all of the consequences of the Constitution. Indeed, under that Constitution, this House went from being a House of Assembly to our Parliament. And therein lies part of the challenge for this House, that we have a modern Constitution underpinning a Parliament, and yet the organisation of this House, the way it does its business, is based on the architecture, in our view, of a legislative assembly underpinned by constitutional arrangements that this community has outgrown. Of course, there are other reasons why parliamentary reform is necessary, not least because we have to make a genuine effort, in our view, to make the proceedings of this Parliament as accessible and as relevant to people as possible. The GOP's long-standing position is that it is supportive of any attempt to reform and modernise the way that Parliament operates. That is not a position we take for the first time today, and this motion is a well-established position of this party going back a number of years. It will be recalled that in 2009 we convened a select committee on parliamentary reform. I don't want to get bogged down into the reasons why that committee only met twice. Those have been ventilated in the past, both in this House and outside the House. But in 2001, the then Chief Minister, Mr. Caruana, moved a motion resolving for the House to convert that select committee into a committee of the whole House in order to allow members to discuss and consider a number of principles that ought to underpin the reform and modernisation of Parliament and its work. Most, though not all, of those principles, with some exceptions, are reflected in the report and the recommendations that we are considering today. Thus, the motion presented by my learned and honourable friend included the principle that each minister should appear in Parliament at least once a month to answer questions about his or her ministerial responsibility, and that the Chief Minister should answer questions once every 2 weeks, with standing orders limiting the duration of each monthly session, whilst recognising that the House is too small for the need of widespread use of multiple parliamentary committees, as in other larger parliaments, the motion recommended that there should be at least one standing general purpose select committee, chaired by a member of the opposition, able to summon ministers, officials, and others in any policy area in the case of select committees in the UK. It included televising of parliamentary proceedings, the modernisation of standing orders, and the reform of the rules to ensure that opposition obtain a monthly opportunity to bring motions for debate in Parliament, which is possible under current rules,
But given that only the government controls the ability to suspend standing orders to allow such a motion to be taken before the end of government business, it also has the ability to delay that motion to a time when it is least convenient for members of the press and therefore least effective. We can debate as much as we want, but whilst the government controls the ability to have that debate heard on the political equivalent, in my view, of Siberia on an exceptionally cold day, namely very late on Friday evening, and I have found myself questioning the father of the house on exceptionally cold and late Friday evening, the effectiveness of motions as a means to hold the government to account will be severely restricted. That is why my honourable friend Mr. Caruana was proposing to reform the parliamentary timetable tool and have specific slots for debating opposition motions, which I hope is an idea that can be taken forward with any future reform under this process, despite the fact that it doesn't appear to be any recommendation to that effect. But Mr. Speaker, in our view as an opposition, the single most important proposal by Mr. Caruana during his motion was the proposal to enlarge Parliament from 17 to 25 members in order to allow backbenchers on both sides of the House. During the debate on the 2011 motion, in my contribution, I said that whilst I only spoke for myself, the issue of enlargement of Parliament to create backbenchers was so critical that I did not believe we could have profound reform of our parliamentary system without it. Nothing that has transpired since then has changed my mind. It is, of course, a DLD manifesto commitment. Unfortunately, Mr. Speaker, it is a commitment which cannot be fulfilled even if we were in government, because constitutionally it requires support of a two-thirds majority of this House. At the time of the 2011 motion, this is the only issue that indeed separated both sides of the House, and it is the only issue that prevented a consensus either on the motion presented by my learned and honourable friend Mr. Caruana, or indeed the amended motion presented by or moved by Mr. Lipudi. It may be recalled that one leader of the opposition went through the motion point by point, agreeing to all of them except for the enlargement of Parliament for the purpose of creating backbenchers. I hope, Mr. Speaker, that I can prevail on honourable members opposite to support the principle of enlargement of Parliament. I recognise that the issue of enlargement could bring to bear considerations of the electoral system in order to elect any additional members, but it does not have to be so. And my preferred option, our preferred option, for reasons that I will develop in a moment, is to simply increase the number of candidates fielded by political parties at election teams. It was, of course, specifically envisaged that it might be desirable to enlarge Parliament when we were negotiating the new constitution with the United Kingdom. It was a devoted delegation in the proposals that we put to the United Kingdom that included the power to enlarge Parliament. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, if at the time of those negotiations we on the Gibraltar side felt that for those reasons we should have the power to enlarge Parliament, we must have believed that at some point in the future it might be desirable for us to do precisely that, to enlarge Parliament. Honourable members who were present during those negotiations, Mr. Speaker, the Father of the House, the Deputy Chief Minister, and the then Chief Minister, Mr. Caruana, will recall the United Kingdom's side of the negotiation, the negotiating forum was concerned that this did not open the door simply to expanding Parliament so that the executive could get even bigger and a Chief Minister could appoint as many ministers as there were MPs on the government side. This is why the Constitution contained a formula which caps the number of ministers that can be appointed, thus ensuring that the rest of any large Parliament would be effectively backbenchers. Mr. Speaker, I have to respectfully say that I find this part of the report at paragraph 2.17 such a lack of focus. I do not know whether that stems from the fact that the enlargement of Parliament appears to have been considered in the context of the creation of constituencies, and was thus conflated with that issue, or because the Commission was mainly focusing on the issue in the context of government backbenches and not opposition backbenches. At the very least, these appear to be the principal considerations as far as we can see from the report. Again, with respect to my friend, Mr. Robert Bassett, who I respect considerably, we are not in favour of the creation of constituencies or wards for the selection of backbenches. Gibraltar is simply too small in our view for such a system to work. The premise for Mr. Bassett's proposal appears to be based on the premise that there is a deficiency in access between constituents and their MP, which would be improved by dividing Gibraltar into constituencies. I do not believe that deficiency exists. We are a community of 30,000 people, and it is probably one of the few communities in the world where you can gain access to government ministers or shadow ministers within a very short period of time. I hold surgeries every Wednesday, every other Wednesday, and I meet people every Friday. My colleagues on this side of the house have similar systems. I do, however, agree with Mr. Bassett that when a front bench spokesman of the opposition takes up an individual case, either in Parliament or by raising it with a minister or a department, it could be perceived as being tainted by political bias or political consideration. In other words, the governing party may have a tendency to analyse them with suspicion and scepticism and possibly consider them in a negative light. A backbencher dedicated purely to constituency work may not be hampered in that way. The argument, of course, Mr. Speaker, has its limits because the government and shadow ministers in the UK do see constituents at the local constituency surgery. But Mr. Speaker, the thrust of Mr. Vance's minority report is that he very much favours enlargement of Parliament to create backbenches, and we certainly agree with that. Mr. Speaker, I have not conducted analysis of every other Parliament in the Western Hemisphere, but there cannot be many where those elected to it for the first time are effectively plunged into ministerial or shadow ministerial roles. In other words, that person may find himself or herself as a lawyer or a nurse or a school teacher one day and running a ministry the next, simply through lack of choice in the way that we have structured our Parliament. There are many examples where people coming into this Parliament or the House of Assembly for the first time have made very substantial contributions to politics, but it's not a good system. It's not a good system. It's not only a question as to whether that person is good enough or apt for ministerial or shadow ministerial office. Our system may actually discourage people from standing for election. People with expertise in certain fields or the experience of life who can genuinely make a contribution from the backbenches without wanting to hold ministerial office, or people who may in time be the ministers or the shadow ministers of tomorrow who, having had the benefit of a political apprenticeship in the backbenches, will be much more prepared for the job they may face in the future. There are many reasons why people may want to become members of Parliament, but not a government minister or a shadow minister. There may be professional or family reasons. The fact that someone may want to participate in the political process or the legislative process does not mean that he or she may want to do so full time to the exclusion of his or her profession or the running of their business. I can think of many leaders in their respective fields in this community that would enrich this Parliament with their contributions, but will not be able to commit to leading that profession or business or a role as a full-time government minister or indeed a shadow minister. You may also have young children, and the time is not right for you to commit to being a government minister or shadow minister, but you still want to and can contribute to the parliamentary process by becoming a member of Parliament. The reasons are many and are also varied. On our side of the House, of course, Mr. Caruana will be sole backbencher. No one can seriously exegetes, the good contributions to this house are not welcome. We should be encouraging people, like Mr. Caruana, to stay in Parliament, not leave after a term, because if he stands, he's effectively standing for election for ministerial office. In other words, he'd be standing for government, not to be a backbencher on the government side. I know in a number of years that decide to step down as leader of the GUD. Why should I, after having spent many years in the front bench on both sides of the House, have to decide in an all or nothing decision that if I wanted to stand for election, it's to offer myself for election as a government minister rather than help my party and indeed the community as a whole by effectively being prepared to stand for election as part of a backbench, part of my party's team. Mr. Speaker, this must be one of the few parliaments in the world in which, if you wish to stand as member of parliament, you are in effect standing for the cabinet, or for government ministerial office. I don't believe that is a credible state of affairs. Mr. Speaker, not only does our present system exclude people that, quite frankly, we should not be excluding, but I believe that having backbenchers would hugely increase the quality of our democracy. It's often said that the most effective opposition to government very often comes from the backbenchers because of the propensity in any given situation where people feel strongly enough about a particular issue to vote against the government. At the present moment, every member of this parliament, bar one, is subject to the principles of collective cabinet or shadow cabinet responsibility. Unless there is a free vote on an issue or a member feels so strongly about an issue that he resigns from the front bench, or from parliament, which is after all testing the nuclear option, he or she has to express their views privately in cabinet or shadow cabinet, and after a decision is taken, support that decision and that line. The ability for that of backbenchers to break ranks from the party line is one of the most enriching factors in any democracy. Fair, Mr. Speaker. The system we have at present effectively entrenches people in the ministerial or shadow ministerial position, irrespective and regardless of whether they are doing a good or a bad job. Neither the Honourable, the Chief Minister, nor I have the ability to promote or demote people that they are, whether they're doing a good job or a bad job. You could have someone who is only interested in doing the minimum necessary to get through 4 years and shortchanging the taxpayer and his party. I suppose a Chief Minister of the day could stop that person, but it would seriously hamper the government of the day if, of course, the government, as it is, the clear policy thinks that 10 ministers are unnecessary to conduct government business. On the leader of the opposition side, it would be nonsensical, because other than battered pride, Mr. Speaker, the practical consequence, when one thinks about it, is for that person effectively to go from doing some work to doing less work if he was sacked from the front bench to go into the opposition benches. It would, of course, Mr. Speaker, allow the promotion of someone else to the front bench, or it would allow the demotion of someone if he felt that person was not putting his or her weight. It's how it works everywhere else. By excluding backbenchers from our parliamentary system, we do democracy in this jurisdiction a huge disservice. Mr. Speaker, the irony is that many of the recommendations that are made in the report, which are very worthwhile indeed, relating to the creation of committees, are, when one examines them very closely, dependent for their true effectiveness on the enlargement of Parliament and the creation of backbenchers. In relation to select committees, for example, the report says, and I quote, "There has been broad support from the respondents for a greater use of select committees as a significant and effective measure in raising the profile and significance of Parliament, since without them, Parliament is handicapped in the general running of parliamentary business." End quote. We agree, Mr. Speaker, with that entirely. But the Commission is absolutely right when it says, in the preceding paragraph, and I quote, we have considered whether select committees should be created and how they should be made in order to fulfill their task. We question whether select committees would be a realistic possibility, given that the matters have become so polarized and confrontation in local politics as to make them unworkable. On the other hand, we feel that a greater use of select committees could serve to diminish negative perception of local politics. End quote. It is precisely because members of the select committees are subject to cabinet or shadow cabinet collective responsibility and will bring no independence to bear on the process, that it is adversarial and by and large it does not work. If we enlarge Parliament and we have backbenchers leading on these select committees, I believe that a completely different attitude will ensue. The same applies to the Public Bills Committee in Section 2.7 of the report. I doubt very much whether these committees will be effective, as they could be without backbenchers. The crux of the problem can clearly be seen in the way the report treats the issue of standing committees and the Public Accounts Committee in particular. It says in the fourth paragraph, Section 2.10, that, and again I quote, we are of the view that the 1980-84 Public Accounts Committee proved ineffective, impracticable and unworkable, particularly because ministers were expected to scrutinize and question senior executives of their ministerial college department. If a public accounts committee were to be set up, it would be essential for government backbenchers to take the place of ministers. We have concluded that there is no need to establish a general purpose standing committee nor a public accounts committee, given that opposition members have every opportunity to examine government expenditure in detail, as well as debating the report from the principal auditor on the government account for every financial year. End quote. In my view, that conflates desirability and necessity with workability under the current system. Of course it's not workable under the current system of front benches on both sides of the House, but the question is whether it's desirable or necessary in a mature democracy. And the answer, in our view, is yes. There ought to be some mechanism where members of Parliament can hold ministers and departments to account. In nitty-gritty terms, much more so than would be appropriate in the normally structured and normally operated question time. And it should not just be once a year in the committee stage of the budget that the opposition members are given the opportunity to examine government expenditure as the report says. We believe that there is room for at least one standing committee of Parliament to serve that role, but backbenchers, again, in our special view, would be essential. Mr. Speaker, of course, we don't agree with you, and the issue of enlargement of Parliament necessitates consideration of the means by which we are going to elect members of that enlarged Parliament. I believe that the answer is very simple. All we need to do is to increase the number of people on a slate at election time from 10 to 15 per party. That would give you more possible variation than the current slate of 10 will give you, because of the larger numbers, but within predictable parameters. At the moment, you have a 10-7 difference across the floor of the House, or a 9-8 difference. With slates of 15, you would have a 15-10, a 13-12, or a 14-11 difference. It may even afford greater opportunity for independents or leaders of third parties to break the block vote, because with the slightly increased variable, people may be more likely and inclined to break their block vote, to vote for one person outside the bloc, if, for example, they know that their preferred party would still be elected in government with a majority of 14-11 if the Christian people did likewise. Mr. Speaker, I refer to the words of a member of the committee, the Honourable Fabian Burnett, during the debate on the 2011 motion, when he said, and I quote, as far as backbenchers are concerned, Mr. Speaker, their presence can only improve the quality and diversity of opinion in debate. I do not see any reason why a change to 15 candidates cannot quickly percolate into the minds of the electorate in the same way as I do not recall any difficulty in the change from 8 to 10 candidates percolating into the minds of the former electorate as a result of the new constitution. End quote. I believe he was absolutely right to make that point during that debate. and I adopt those words to make precisely the same point today.
Indeed,
I note that the Commission recommends that the consideration of technology and technological advances in relation to the accounting of votes should be explored. I can't imagine that an increase from 10 to 15 votes per person will add any expense or time to the process in the light of modern technological advances. The Speaker, the report says that a majority of 22 individuals and one organisation that participated in the process did not agree with enlargement. I note the report says that not all responded on all the issues. For that reason, and because I don't know how many supported or opposed the idea, I can't quantify the term majority of responders when at paragraph 2.17, the Commission says that the majority, and I quote, the majority of responders are also opposed to any increase in the size of the Parliament as the electorate is well served by 17 elected members, end quote. We certainly don't agree that the electorate is well served by 17 members for the reasons that I have articulated. But it is also noteworthy that the GLD and the PDP were at the last election both committed to an enlargement of Parliament in our respective manifestos, and over 60% of the electorate voted for those manifestos. People in general elections vote for very different reasons and on many issues. I'm not suggesting that everyone who voted for both parties were in favour of enlargement, but neither do I believe that a consultation exercise where only 22 people commented on enlargement is determinative of the views of the community on the issue, particularly when the arguments have not been fully articulated. Indeed, I note that in section 15 of the consultation document, not the report, 3 out of 4 paragraphs in the section on constituencies and members of Parliament are on constituencies and only one on the issue of backbenchers. We believe that bearing in mind the importance of enlargement to this side of the House and to the parties representing over half the electorate, that it should have been considered as a separate issue, separate from the question of constituencies or wards, and that the main argument should have been canvassed if we are to rely on the views of responders as representing the views of the general public on this issue. Clearly, we believe we can. Mr. Speaker, the report, not the consultation paper, also says that, I quote, additional expenditure is unwarranted, end quote. We don't believe that it is unwarranted or that the expenditure needs to be particularly onerous. My Honourable and Learned Friend, Mr. Caruana, during the 2011 motion, made it clear that we were proposing that a scale of pay in relation to back benches that should be introduced, but was less than for front bench spokesmen on the opposition side. Much may depend on the role they play within committees. If somebody clearly is performing a role and giving of their time in select committees, they ought to or justifies paying more than somebody who is just simply being a backbencher without being involved in a committee. But the benefits of democracy in having backbenchers when balanced against a relatively modest additional expense makes the decision, in our view, a relatively easy one when carefully considered and weighed. Mr. Speaker, of course, even if we had been elected into government at the next election, we could not force enlargement of Parliament with a parliamentary majority. Constitutionally, it requires a two-thirds majority of this House. I note that Mr. Likudi, the Lord for the GSP Liberals, on the debate on parliamentary reform in 2011, proposed a possible referendum on the issue, on some of the issues that he was then postulating and we were debating in this House. We believe that rather than just simply use their parliamentary vote to block enlargement, the government should agree to put this issue to the people in a referendum. This is an important enough issue to be put to people, and it would be consonant with the views that they expressed on the 2011 motion. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to question and answer. We agree partially with recommendation 3 and entirely with recommendation 5 and 6. We don't agree with recommendation 4, and we do not agree that each minister be limited to 2 hours when, for example, Mr. Likudi has a number of portfolios, and it would be impossible to do justice to all of them
in that time. Our preference, if we are to have a time limit, would be to limit the amount of time per portfolio. But the limiting of time on second times is not something that, in fact, we're against. It's formed the subject of a motion that Mr. Dallara brought in 2011, and it's certainly something that we can live with and agree with that recommendation. But the reason why I'm dealing with this issue is because there are a number of matters, Mr. Speaker, of importance that we would like to make. But it is that we agree that questions should avoid long preambles and that they should be short and sharp, to coin a phrase used by Mr. Speaker a number of weeks ago, rather than, but of course, and I think that this is recognised by the Leader of the House during his own intervention, it obviously also has to be reciprocated. An answer that should be short and sharp rather than have political speeches. We have no problem with the idea that Chief Minister's questions should be limited to 3 hours, provided, of course, the Speaker is alert to the fact that lengthy and perhaps irrelevant answers could very easily be used as a device to run the clock down. Now, I'm not suggesting that that is going to be formed a feature of question and answer sessions in the future, because I recognise that the Honourable the Leader of the House has been today during his own intervention said that he's effectively not supporting the idea of having a limited time for Chief Minister's question time. But Mr. Speaker, I want to say something about the comments made in the report about the relaxation of the rules in recent years and comments made by Mr. Speaker during the last session of question and answers that many people have commented to him that past exchanges in this House have put people off listening to Parliament. If I paraphrased it wrongly, I apologise, but I think that's the gist of the words that were used or what was said. Mr. Speaker, it's certainly true that there have been exchanges in the past that does no one any credit at all. I think that where we have failed in the past is that exchanges across the floor of the House have become, in some instances, questionable. I have references to members of my family, so have others within this House. There have been excesses on both sides of the House, and I recognise them. I have to say, however, Mr. Speaker, that on balance, members of this House are far better behaved than members of other parliaments. I often watch reports from Prime Minister's question time or question and answers in the UK Parliament. And some of the things that I see, Mr. Speaker, make us look like veritable Boy Scouts in the distilled estates, if I can call it that. And certainly, we on this side of the House feel very strongly that we also have to guard against the other extreme, and that is that question and answer sessions become a mechanical exercise devoid of any ability by the opposition to hold the government to account at a political level. Our role is to hold the government to account by at times exposing the fact that the government is mishandling a particular issue or is mistaken about a particular policy. We make no apologies for that. Whether it raises tensions in the House or not, as long as it does not become personalised, and we respect reasonable standards of good behaviour. Of course, questions have to be factual, and they cannot be a pretext for debate. But you cannot take the politics out of question and answers with constant intervention from the chair every time supplementary questions are asked, on the grounds that temperatures are rising. Otherwise, the rising of temperatures can be used as a simple device by the government of the day to force us to move on to the next question. The consequence will be that we will not be able to do the job that we've been elected to do. Nothing in our respectful view will do a greater disservice to the parliamentary process. Indeed, I predict that people will turn away from tuning in to the parliamentary question and answers, which at the end of the day must be one of the objectives given that we've agreed to televise the proceedings. We are all politicians. People may tune into BBC or read reports in the Chronicle to find out, I don't know, about how many trees
have been planted in their particular area, and that's fine. That's part of information that may be relevant to parts of the community or the community. But they're also interested, equally interested, in finding out whether the government has been able to provide cogent answers to the political issues of the day, the issues that are capable, in some instances, yes, of balancing the government or the opposition if you get it wrong. Mr. Speaker, I was watching BBC television on Sunday morning 2 weeks ago, where there were specific questions put to Nick Clegg, the Deputy Prime Minister by a Conservative backbencher. And the question related to a leaflet that Mr. Clegg had called to be published in his photograph, advocating an EU referendum in 2009. The questioner sarcastically asked whether that photograph was a photograph of the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Deputy Prime Minister, or a photograph of an imposter. Now, he was making a political point. It was an effective political point. It provoked a level of noise in the chamber and much laughter. No one said the question is improper or it's going to raise temperatures or do not make clever remarks. Mr. Speaker, if we take out the ability of members to make political points of that nature, you run the risk of making question and answer sessions into a complete damp squib. The same applies to the issue of supplementary questions. You can't always get it collectively right. I include that, and I include myself in that assessment. But there has to be some flexibility in order to allow us to do our job. Our concern with recommendation 3 is that it should not be an excuse to turn question and answer sessions into anything other than what it is, a political question and answer session. I hope that when a point is taken by the chair about the appropriateness of a supplementary for whatever reason, or temperatures do rise, that we're allowed from the floor to explain why we believe it was an appropriate supplementary, or why we should be allowed to continue with a particular line of questioning. When you're told, at the end of the day, Mr. Speaker, every time that the chair takes a particular point about the appropriateness of a supplementary question, what the chair is effectively doing is it's taking a point of order. It is saying that question is not within standing audience. And Mr. Speaker, on a number of occasions, Mr. Speaker has said that that question does not arise from the original question. Well, perhaps if we had been allowed to explain why we're asking a particular question, we would have said that standing orders provide not that the question arises from the supplementary arises from the original question, but a supplementary question does not include matter not included in the original question. The Chief Minister is absolutely right. It's about relevance to the subject matter of the original question. And indeed, if we go to FMA and look at the admissibility supplementary question at page 305, oral answer supplementary question, it says, and I quote, a supplementary question may refer only to the answer out of which it immediately arises. Now, the point about that is, that if a minister, and I am going to be referring to a particular example at the last session, if a minister says, I have not briefed, or we have not briefed the mayor of Lalinia about the fishing report, and I have a statement from the government that basically calls into question whether that is correct or is not correct, that is a perfectly valid supplementary question in our view. Look, it may be, I see that the Honourable Representative does not agree, and I'm also right, because the point that I'm making is that at the very least, we should be allowed to express why the question was admissible in the first instance. That's the point that I make. And I accept that, look, there may be different views. I may not get it right sometimes, but at the very least, that I ought to be allowed to express the reason why I am asking that supplementary question and why I believe that the question
is admissible without being told, you do not have the floor, and without being able to express our views on it. When we are told, Mr. Speaker, you do not have the floor, we will abide by it. But we are entitled to be heard as to where we are going with a particular line of questioning that we may think is actually being quite effective. And all that we ask on this side of the House is that we are allowed the ability to just simply explain why we think that the question was an appropriate question in the second session. That is all. And I hope that the comments that I have made are taken in the spirit that they are intended to be as constructive as possible in the way that these proceedings are conducted in the future, that allows us to do our job effectively, allows the chair to do his job, which no doubt he does always to the best of his ability and impartially, and also the government does their job in answering questions. Mr. Speaker, I turn to turn table. Speaker, the Honourable Lady, Mr. Galil Hammond, will be speaking about parliamentary timetable. Over the last 6 or 7 months, question and answer sessions have been spread over a number of days and sometimes weeks. Sessions often start at 3 p.m. and this inevitably drags the question time into several days and sometimes several weeks. There should, in our view, I think in his own intervention, I think that the Chief Minister, if you correct me if I'm wrong in his response, but I detected an acceptance of some of the things that I'm going to be saying, and certainly an acceptance of moving to a situation where we have more predictable timetables for parliamentary proceedings. There should, in our view, be a system whereby we know in advance that particular ministers will be asked questions on a particular day. It's all very well. Yes, of course. I'm not going to interfere the way that the Honourable Gentleman put the issues in this debate, and I've kept a note of things that he said which I'd like to reply to. But can I just refer him to the fact that there is already a timetable which was published on I believe the distributed to members of the opposition, where we set out which ministers we believe, subject to the vagaries of how a question time then develops, are going to be able to answer questions on a particular day. And that is actually made publicly available from the website of the Parliament. I don't know whether I have the impression that this is being published and it's not getting to them at a particular time, but the impression I have is that not only is it made available to the general public, it's specifically made available to members of the different system innovation that we introduced when we were elected. I just want to ask whether he's making the point in the context of that or not. Yes, I don't think, I'm not aware of the fact that we receive a timetable indicating the order in which the ministers will answer questions. I don't think, and that's that's not the point that I make. I don't think it actually works. What we are saying from this side of the House is that there ought to be a timetable where, for example, Chief Minister answers questions on a Thursday, by force exigencies of his own business on a Thursday. But then we have a situation where other ministers are also allocated particular times or particular days in a week so that we know in advance when members opposite will have an opportunity to question members opposite. Because, you see, it's all very well to criticize management sessions that the report does, but question and answers should be spread over 2 days at the most. At the moment, Chief Minister's question is on the Thursday. It may not be possible to adhere to that timetable, as I've said, every month because ministerial demands, but some system of advance notice should be agreed. They can plan their question and ministerial diary around their timetable because they know when they have to answer questions on when or when bills will be debated, but we don't. My diary is entirely organized around my political commitment, my own diary. But I also have professional commitments. That's the reality of our parliamentary system. And, you know, I know that the Honourable Member will say to me that they never had notice of when bills were debated or questions answered when they were on our side of the House. I mean, it's a perfectly valid point. But, of course,
We've now moved on to monthly meetings, where meetings are being adjourned after just 2 hours and dragged on for 4 weeks sometimes. It's not that we are dealing with questions on 1 week, question and answers 1 week. We're sometimes dealing with question and answers over 2, and it's happened in the past 3 weeks. Now, it's simply not possible for members on this side of the House to plan their diaries around a Parliament at the present moment. And I give the House this commitment that if we were elected into government, if I became Chief Minister, and he was not prepared to do it, we would move to introduce a system of fixed dates for question and answers with advance warning of if those dates are likely to vary. And that would be included in our manifesto in 2015. In other words, simply because they may not agree to move to a system that I'm advocating doesn't mean that we are not going to be doing, that we're not going to be moving towards such a system if we get elected into government. Mr. Speaker, finally, I want to say something about a Chief Minister not serving more than 2 terms. I was the first politician to advocate this policy 13 years ago. I made submissions to the Select Committee on Constitutional Reform for the inclusion of that policy in the draft constitution. Some of those who today advocated opposed it in their own submissions to that very same Select Committee. I am glad that it's a policy that is too popular, that it's under it being debated. But it's a policy, in my view, that should have been included in the constitution, and it's not apt to be included in an Act of Parliament. An Act of Parliament cannot bind a future government. If you were all to agree to introduce an Act of Parliament tomorrow, it could be repealed in the future. Unless it were included in the Constitution, and that is remote, the issue arises as to how anyone could be bound to this policy in the future. It is therefore for parties to decide what policy they may wish to adopt on this issue at any given time. Yet it's not the policy of my party. My own position as party leader is that if I were ever given the privilege of being elected as Chief Minister in 2015, I would only serve for 2 terms. Mr. Speaker, finally, I'd just like to say this about statements in the House, because it says a point the Honourable Chief Minister made about, I think what he said was that we hadn't effectively given, we taunted him about the official report, but of course it was always his intention to bring it to Parliament at this session of the House. Of course, we didn't know that it was his intention to bring it to Parliament at this session of the House. I think what that says is perhaps there is a greater need for the Chief Minister and myself, or myself and the Deputy Chief Minister, to discuss these issues outside this House. And if we had been told that the Honourable Chief Minister was going to be making it public today, we wouldn't have come out on Monday asking him to make it public. But of course, we didn't know that. And Mr. Speaker, that is my own intervention.
The Honourable Lady. Are you making a formal contribution, or is it a... Sorry, I wasn't aware. Sorry.
I welcome the opportunity to make a short contribution to the debate. Not least for the parliamentary form is an issue that has interested me for many years. I take the opportunity to thank the chairman, the members, and the secretary of the commission for the valuable work. It would be relevant to start by looking backwards at how we reached where we are today, before looking forward into the future. I say this because the proceedings of the House over the past decades have reflected the level of political emancipation that Gibraltar enjoyed at the time. The Speaker, this Parliament started with its place as a debating chamber way back in 1950, where a curious mixture of representatives of the electorate intermingled for the colonial administration of Gibraltar. In those days, the chamber, then a legislative council, was decided over by the governor, important limit for unity. The representatives of the people of Gibraltar ask questions of the colonial administrators, who are the ones writing the government. The proceedings of this chamber changed in the late 1950s, and the number of elected members were increased, and came to be associated with the work of government departments. This meant that instead of questioning the government, meaning the UK colonial government, the elected members instead questioned each other on the work of the departments that they were associated with. This experiment is a prelude to full ministerial responsibility of a government department that came about in the 1964 Constitution. The period from 1950 to 1969 was one of rapid constitutional and political development. It culminates in the creation of the House of Assembly in that year, and the City Council and the Legislative Council merged to form one single representative body. It is important to recall that in 1975, a committee made up of members of this House proposed the creation of a committee system of administration based on the Westminster Government and Assistance System. Instead of being based on the Westminster system, it was based on the system used until recently in Jersey and the Sunday Channel. This was included in the proposals that were made to then Minister of State of the Foreign and Commonwealth Office for Advocacy as part of the package of proposals for political and constitutional reform. The so-called Hatterton Memorandum of 1976 rejected practically everything else that was wanted requested, and suggested that a constitutional feature lay in a direction where we clearly did not want to go. However, the committee system of government was not rejected by the United Kingdom at that time. The next major step in this narrow institutional context did not come about until 2007, when the 2006 constitution was promulgated, and this chamber became the devoted parliament. It is relevant to point out, in the context of the debate today, that standing orders remained largely unchanged, right since the days of the House of Assembly. In January 2009, Mr. Speaker, being a member of the body, alluded to this. The then government moved a motion in the South to create a select committee of parliament to consider the desirable changes to the processes and procedures and the manner in which parliament carried out its business. This was also supposed to look and develop at the desirability of an elementary standing order of the House, where the number of members could be increased, and if so, in what manner and what form this would happen. The committee met once on the 23rd of April of 2009. It did not meet again. The young members then in government proposed that it cease to exist and become a committee of the whole House as a general election occurred in 2011. At that time, it was clear that there were two different views. The view proposed by the honourable members and the view proposed by ourselves, the opposition and now the government of the voters. Mr. Speaker, we have been consistent in government with the roadmap that we set out in opposition. This was to set up a commission on democratic and parliamentary reform with fixed timescales. That commission, as it outlines, was appointed on the 2nd of March of 2012. It was tasked with producing a consultation paper within 3 months. It met the deadline. It was asked to report to Parliament within 12 months of commencing the consultation process. It was well within the deadline. Indeed, the work of the Commission and the fact that they're discussing the report and its recommendations today is a tribute to the hard work of all those who have been involved in it, in a process which has brought to conclusion in the stage of work. Mr. Speaker, my good friend, the Chief Minister, has already outlined the position of the government in relation to the 39 recommendations contained in the report. Those that the government will be supporting and the mechanism for which it is proposed could be taken forward. However, it is important nonetheless to stress that these proposals must be seen in the context of the other reforms of this Parliament that the government has already implemented. These include monthly meetings of the House, except in the UK recess. This alone is a revolutionary change compared to what existed before. Questions can now be asked in a timely manner when events are still current. The setting up of a parliamentary website, the faster production of Hansard and placing it online, making Wi-Fi available in chamber, and increasing the resources of Parliament are also reforms which have already taken place. I have said before that it must be very difficult for members on both sides of the House to envisage today a Parliament where the production of Hansard sometimes took 8 months or even a year. Hansard is now available and online in a few weeks. This was not always the case. The point, Mr. Speaker, is that there has been substantial reform to the way in which a Parliament conducts its business already. Indeed, this has made life easier for the general public, for the media, the staff, and the members of this House. Indeed, the physical refurbishment of the chamber, which started life as the Exchange and Commercial Library in 1817, is also an important landmark, which has helped this House to move forward with the times through a blend of modern design and traditional features. And so, Mr. Speaker, our actions already and the debate we're having today is proof in itself that the government is serious about parliamentary reform and that it remains serious about it. The concern that was expressed not that long ago in this place was that water was being kicked into the long grass. This has now been found to be without foundation, and now it is up to us, the elected representatives of the people, to take the matter forward. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, it is an honour and privilege to address this House on a number of matters which are on this end, believe the opposition has asked me to deal with, mainly matters affecting the internal workings of this House and its members. Firstly, of the Commission's report in the context of the two senses attendance of Parliament, as dealt with at paragraph 2.2, the opposition has no issue with a recommendation made by it. The Commission that the practice which has been observed in this House since time immemorial should continue to be the case, and that the Chief Minister should remain at liberty to attend Parliament as he sees fit, and of course, in order to answer questions made of him. This is not a matter of contention for the opposition. And I now turn to paragraph 2.3 of the Commission's report and the frequency of meetings and recesses. The first observation we would make in this regard is that there is a certain inconsistency in the observations of the Commission and its second recommendation. I recall, as I'm sure all members will, that there was no Christmas recess last year, which observation is correctly made by the Commission's report. However, at recommendation number 2, the Commission recommends that Parliament to continue to have its Christmas and Easter recesses, so that the summer recess should last from the end of July to the third week in September. The opposition is of the view that despite what appears to be a recommendation based on mistaken facts and inconsistent with the Commission's observations, that this Parliament should resolve to meet a minimum of 9 times a year in order to allow for recesses at Christmas, Easter and summer, effectively accepting and endorsing recommendation number 2. Monthly meetings of this Parliament, something which the opposition during its time on government benches supported in its own motion in relation to parliamentary reform, have proved beneficial to the discharge of our responsibilities to the community and in this House. The fact that the House is now meeting on a monthly basis means that the opposition has ample opportunity to raise and deal with topical issues at a time when they are relevant, as mentioned by the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister. The opposition is equally aware of the potentially negative consequences of meeting regularly, mainly and most importantly, the possibility of overloading the community on politics. The opposition accepts that ours is a community which thrives on political debate about it, as with most everything else in life, and it is possible to have too much of a good thing. This is never more so than at the annual budget debate sessions. Lengthy sessions during which a full summary and analysis of the political year gone by and the prospects for the future are delivered and will certainly be described in the words of the Commission as marathon sittings. Last year, in addition to the budget debate sittings, the House then met for questions later that month. The opposition is collectively of the view that in light of the regularity with which Parliament meets and the high volume of political output being produced by both sides currently, the opposition will limit itself to asking questions of the government in the sitting following the budget debate to matters which require urgent attention in the House. Mr. Speaker, I now move on to recommendation 2.4 of the Commission's report. Mr. Speaker, my honourable friend, the Leader of the Opposition, has already spoken on this matter, and this is a matter of questions and answers. And as part of the overhaul of oral questions and answers, I'm following on from recommendation 3 to limit the question time for the chief minister to 3 hours and the ministers to 2 hours. We agree on a system of 6 days for sittings of Parliament. However, we suggest for the timetabling of 6 named days and times in a month, according to the business of Parliament. This certainly helps MPs plan their work and personal diaries around Parliament, especially for working mothers like myself who have young children and need to plan or arrange for the collection from school or nursery or for their after-school activities. We feel that it is becoming a feature of Parliament over the last 6 or 7 months that sessions are dragging out over 2 or 3 weeks. Members of the opposition are part-time, and unless we are prepared to make them full-time, which is not our policy, we have to accept that the reality is that professional business and private and childcare arrangements continue. No tentative timetable should be used as an instrument to keep the opposition MPs guessing as to when they next need to attend Parliament, and thus preventing them from planning their diaries. Indeed, this kind of loop arrangement makes family life difficult to plan at short notice and could certainly discourage single parents from coming into Parliament. We very much welcome the monthly meetings of Parliament. However, because of the increased frequency in the year, we urge for consideration to set a known week amount for Parliament business as it is now. But despite knowledge that Parliament sits the third week of the month, the order of questions, day or times are arbitrarily set, we have found, on a day-to-day basis, making it difficult to plan other MP business or family business, as I've already mentioned. Presently, the third week of the month, which is earmarked for Parliament business and has Thursday afternoon for chief minister's questions, is very welcome. It would also be welcome if, and I suggest this example just to illustrate the point, Mr. Speaker. For example, the Minister for Children sat every Wednesday between 9 and 11 in the morning, the Minister for Justice 11 till 1, the Minister for Housing from 3 to 5, or for an hour for each portfolio. This is something that can be discussed in the select committee. This would also help the ministers in conducting their own government business and be able to plan ahead, knowing that a fixed appearance time and timetable exists. We accept that there has to be flexibility for urgent business, but in most cases it will be easier for all MPs, including ministers, to work around a fixed timetable. On paragraph 2.5, motions for adjournment, and 2.6, statements by the government. The opposition accepts the recommendations 7, 8, and 9, and such recommendations for the opposition, no issue whatsoever. Paragraph 2.7 on committee of bills to select committees, and 2.8 on standing committees. The opposition accepts recommendation 10, showing the view set out by the commission that lengthier, more technical bills, those which are likely to substantially impact on citizens, should undergo in-depth legislative scrutiny by a committee established for that purpose. Mr. Speaker, as the Parliament considers all these issues and drives forward the modernisation agenda, it becomes ever clearer that the case for an enlarged Parliament of 25 members simply cannot be dismissed, as outlined by my honourable friend, the Leader of Opposition. I take this opportunity to reiterate the view on this House, on this side of the House, that the enlargement of Parliament, in the manner explained by my honourable friend, when he had the privilege of leading this House as Chief Minister, and obviously my honourable friend, the Leader of Opposition today, in the softly remodeled Parliament chamber, is critical to the effective delivery of the modernisation and enhancement of the parliamentary process in this place. the increased fees of committees, such as the Public Accounts Committee, will provide an opportunity to backbenchers to participate in the legislative process, actively contributing without being required to step into the breach of the front country. All our arguments in favour of the expansion of this Parliament have been addressed by my honourable friend, the Leader of the Opposition. Moving on to paragraph 2.9, on the Deputy Speaker, we too accept this recommendation, number 11, in light of the fact that Parliament sits for at least 9 times a year, as per the recommendations outlined in section 2.2. We understand that despite the ability of our present and capable Speaker, that because of the increase of work that the Speaker now undertakes, he should be assisted in his parliamentary duties by an appropriately qualified person, such as the Deputy Speaker. We understand there will be occasions when Mr. Speaker will not be available to attend parliamentary sittings, which will continue on a monthly basis. So the chosen Deputy Speaker is therefore able to sit and preside over Parliament in his place and perform the duties in relation to the role as with other parliaments around the world. We believe the Deputy Speaker should also be a non-elected member who, like the Speaker, and appointed by the Parliament by a resolution passed by a simple majority of its members and presented by the Chief Minister acting after consultation with the Leader of the Opposition. On paragraph 2.10 on the remuneration of members of Parliament, this side of the House does not quite understand what the issue is and indeed what the need for a review is. However, we are open-minded about it. If the need for a review is to examine whether new entrants to Parliament should have different terms in respect of pension rights, we will certainly listen to any arguments in favour of it. We believe that there are pros and cons in respect of changing the system with regards to pensions. We do not think the analogy with the civil service reforms is helpful, as the entrants' pension rights are different to those applicable to the civil service. Changing pension rights to contributory pensions may well be attractive to some people because, at the moment, unless you serve 90 months in the past, you do not qualify for a pension. What's more, any reduction in incentives to stand for election by curbing the MP's existing pension rights will discourage individuals further from putting their name forward to serve their country. However, we believe the present system does not reward those who have contributed to public life for less than 90 months. A penalty that Mr. Keith has about to suffer by a few weeks, despite his service to Gibraltar, and this cannot be right. But as I mentioned at the beginning, we are open-minded about this, and will consider any such proposals in this regard in the spirit of constructive dialogue. With regard to paragraph 2.11 on the members of interest and parliamentary code, recommendation number 14 is one that also has our unanimous support, Mr. Speaker. Seeing that there has been no review of the Register of Members' Interest, first drawn up in 1979, and it is certainly time to do so. This enables the updating of the rules, plus the introduction of a parliamentary code, as recommended in recommendation 15. As with the UK, and in light of the expensive scandal of the UK MPs, which started in 2009 and which rocked Westminster, the electorate rightly expects an appropriate code of conduct for MPs in discharging their parliamentary and public duties. The purpose of declaring interest is to provide information on any financial or non-financial benefit received by an MP, which might reasonably be sought by others to influence their actions, speeches, or votes in Parliament, or influence the actions taken in the capacity as a Member of Parliament. With regard to recommendation 15, we believe the drafting of a parliamentary code reflects the code of conduct for the UK Members of Parliament, whose purpose is to assist members in the discharge of their obligations to the House, their constituents, and the public at large by A, providing guidance on the standards of conduct for members in discharging their parliamentary and public duties, and in so doing, providing the openness, and accountability necessary to reinforce public confidence in the way in which members perform those duties. We therefore agree it is essential that suitably qualified persons should be conducting such a review and outlining our parliamentary code, and we accept that an appropriate independent authority from the UK be commissioned to such a task. However, any code should be approved by a majority of members of Parliament or any select committee convened for that purpose. In line with making our Parliament more open and relevant to the electorate, we concur that the register of members' interests can be made available on the Parliament's website. With regard to the ministerial code, we also agree with Recommendation 16. A review of the Gibraltar Ministerial Code is long overdue since the enactment of the 1969 Constitution. As per the preamble to this recommendation in the report, we believe the Ministerial Code should be brought into line with that applicable to MPs in the UK, which sets out the rules and standards for government ministers. Such a code helps preserve the public trust in the institution of cabinet government and its principles reassure the electorate that voted them into government. The UK's Committee on Standards and Public Life outlines seven principles which we feel should also be applicable to Gibraltar ministers. One, selflessness, ministers should act entirely in the public interest. Two, integrity, no financial obligation should be accepted or they could undermine the minister's position. Three, objectivity, when making appointments, decisions should be based on merit. Four, accountability, all public office holders are accountable and should cooperate with all scrutiny procedures. Five, openness, all decisions should be justified and information should be restricted only when necessary for the public interest. Six, honesty, public office holders are required by duty to be honest in all their dealings and business. And seven, leadership, the principles should be supported and upheld by leadership and example. Again, any code should be approved by a majority of members of Parliament or any select committee convened for that purpose. Paragraph 2.13 is on the televising of parliamentary proceedings. And as to the Commission's recommendation 17, this is one of the proposals made in 2011 by my honourable friend, Mr. Gahuana, during his motion to reform and modernise Parliament and its work, which read, parliamentary meetings which are already broadcast on BBC Radio should also be broadcast on BBC Television. And also a motion has already been approved by this House to this effect in February of this year. As a consequence, we are already well on our way to making this a reality. What remains is an agreement across the floor as to the rules governing the televising of proceedings in terms of how and what, as stated by the Honourable the Chief Minister in presenting the motion at February's sitting of Parliament. This setup is in place. The setup is in place, and we, as have many responders to the Commission on Democratic and Political Reform, support this recommendation. And as the Honourable the Chief Minister already stated, the opposition has received yesterday from the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister draft rules based on the Westminster model that need looking into in detail and adjusting for the purpose of any Gibraltar rules. And then those draft rules will be adopted by way of another motion as stated by the Honourable the Chief Minister in February. For the public, the televising of Parliament proceedings again improves access to information, making Parliament more relevant, and also improves the accountability of the executive. On paragraph 2.14, the news media. Mr. Speaker, we are neutral on this recommendation number 18. However, we do reject completely the third paragraph of the preamble, as we do not agree with the premise under which it is made. As to a recommendation, we are happy to receive in Parliament any annual report published by the media director on the activities of his or her department in the future. But I'm not sure what this has got to do with parliamentary reform. Some reports are laid in Parliament, it is because statute provides for it to be laid. Presumably, the government will supplement the Broadcasting Act if we accept this recommendation. But as I said, we are neutral on this issue apart from the statement alleging corruption. Moving on to paragraph 2.15 on select committees.
Can you repeat which paragraph it is you said is against?
It's the third paragraph of the preamble, just before recommendation 18.
Is her position that she's suggesting that this is is self-suggesting corruption. Would that be the same?
The opposition is that position in relation to that is that it is a totally unnecessary statement. We don't agree with it. It's certainly a statement that's been made that can be interpreted as a statement of impropriety in the funding of a newspaper. So we don't support it. That's the position of the opposition. And I have faith in that.
Okay, the Honourable Gentleman considers that that statement was made of the government as much before the 8th of December 2011, because we, although politically we might leave it in that way, if we wish to, it doesn't identify any of the temporary government of the day.
Well, indeed, but you have interpreted in relation to the funding of a particular newspaper, that's how we interpret it in ourselves. Now, to the extent that we don't know what's going through the minds of those that are commissioning this particular report, to the extent that that is an allegation in relation to improper funding of a particular newspaper, we certainly do not agree with it. Indeed, I could have gone further. I don't want this debate to be marred by this particular issue, but I could.
Would it help if I were to say that the commission did not receive any representation from any political party other than the PDP? Other than the PDP, all the respondents were individuals. They did not represent any organization. And my recollection is that this is a reference to some representation that was received from an individual in this specific matter.
I am very grateful to the speaker, but of course, it may be reflective of an opinion expressed by somebody who has contributed his views in relation to it. But the fact that it's been worked its way into the report obviously has necessitated, certainly on this side of the house, for us to deal with it. Indeed, it necessitated the Chief Minister dealing with it, because the Chief Minister, when he was dealing with this particular part of it, he referred to the 7 days, but the Honourable Lady has limited herself in saying that we can't support this particular paragraph because of the imputation that is made. Equally, she could have said, in response to the Chief Minister, the comments made by the Chief Minister, well, it may be a reference to the 7 days, it may be a reference to the Panorama newspaper, which could be also susceptible to a comment, the same comment as the Chief Minister made in the 7 days. All we say, and we do not want to mar this debate in any way, shape, or form at all, is that we do not support the imputation that is made in that paragraph. However, in whatever direction, if I can put it that way, that imputation is directed.
Think of it. This is really quite extraordinary. If the Honourable Member says he doesn't want to mark this debate, he goes on to say,
may I make one thing clear? We are not in committee. The rules of debate apply. Now, Honourable Members all have an opportunity to make a contribution to this debate, but we cannot have any particular member, not even a minister, standing up 3 or 4 times unless whoever holds the floor gets ready.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, is absolutely right, and therefore I would ask the, not sure who holds the floor at this stage, the Honourable Lady, if he would give way, and if it's in fact conducive to the debate, to have contributions while statements are being made. Otherwise, it just ends up being statements being read out without any debate. So, will the Honourable Member give way? I'm obliged. What I said, Mr. Speaker, is that the Leader of the Opposition has indicated that it wants to mark this debate and doesn't know what was going through the minds of members of the Commission when they set out this particular part of the report, in particular, that paragraph 3. But the Honourable Lady has used in this house the word corruption, and that needs to be clarified. What is it that she's implying? Is it suggesting that the Commission took the view that there was corruption, and therefore this recommendation is necessary to avoid corruption, or where did that come from? If that is their view, let them say it.
Mr. Speaker. I am the leader of the opposition. No, Mr. Speaker, this is not. I am the leader of the opposition. This is the.
I think I will remember that he speaks to the other way to vote him. That's all that the dialogue suggests.
The Honourable Lady has indicated to me that she's giving way.
Now, I also agree with her position.
What the Honourable Lady has done is actually alight on a possible interpretation of this particular paragraph. But it says that the significant public funds have been given to media outlets that have supported the political view of the government of the day in a manner that may not have been justified. Now that's taken to interpretation in a number of ways. We don't believe, including an allegation of possible impropriety by the government of the day. We don't think that that allegation is justified, either in, as the Chief Minister pointed out when doing his own intervention, either in relation to the 7 days, or indeed to the funding by us and now by the government, by the incumbent government, of the Panorama newspaper, which is entirely supportive of members of this and not of this party. Now, the honourable lady, it's up to her, but the honourable lady is certainly not going to give way again. And she's going to continue with a few.
Ask the honourable lady if she will read again, because I thought I had an oath of it, but I don't, and if she will read again for the purposes of my reply, the sentence that refers to corruption, just so I have an oath of it for my reply.
Mr. Speaker, I've already given way. I've been very generous to allow this, and I'd like to make some progress. Just move on to paragraph 2.15 and select committee. As to this section, Mr. Speaker, the recommendation to nominate select committees where appropriate is welcomed by the private side of the House, especially with the presence of backbenchers in the House. These arguments have already been covered by the discourse among all friends and leader of the opposition on the enlargement of Parliament, and also by comments made by means of sections 2.7 and 2.8 on committal bills to select committee and standing committee. Mr. Speaker, moving on to paragraph 2.16 and petition to Parliament. Again, in order to make our Parliament more relevant to the electorate and to allow them to engage in debate on issues and policies that are meaningful to the community, this recommendation is welcome. However, the devil is in the detail of how this could be implemented. The system was introduced in the United Kingdom in 2011, whereby a petition on an issue with a minimum of 100,000 signatories is required to be debated in the House of Commons. This does not mean approval of the views of the petitioner. However, it empowers the public, makes them feel included further in the democratic process where they feel their voice is being heard. In the Scottish Parliament, every Wednesday in the debating chamber, they have what is called time for reflection, where an invited person addresses the Parliament for a few minutes, sharing his or her thoughts on an issue. This type of setup could be considered as an appropriate way for the main mover of the petition to present the issue to the chamber for further debate. We considered what an equivalent or relative to the UK minimum number of signatures required for a petition to be debated in Gibraltar was. 100,000 petitioners is about 1.4% of the UK's population. A relative figure for Gibraltar would be around 40 petitioners. Certainly, we believe, far too low a figure to endorse debates within our Parliament. So we believe careful consideration needs to be taken as to the minimum number required. We are very lucky to have a very politically aware and participatory electorate, and franchised and willing to engage in our political and democratic systems. We are also, as a people, very keen to support each other in raising awareness and in signing petitions for causes. As a consequence, the accumulation of signatories to get into debate in Parliament could be a relatively easy task in Gibraltar. So a realistic but manageable figure needs to be set to enhance public participation that is not abused any new system that may be set up. We propose a minimum of 1,000 signatories to be collected to make this recommendation a reality. However, this would be a matter for the select committee to discuss and to agree on. Mr. Speaker, section 2.17 is on constituencies and the number of members of parliament, and we concur with the majority of the members of the commission and do not agree with the division of Gibraltar into constituency areas, nor that MPs should be associated with separate precincts, as explained by my honourable friend, the Leader of the Opposition. Thanks to the close community we live in, members of the public have easy access to MPs at the community level and have recourse to ministers directly through daily appointments. The personal contact with the public exists, the MPs are known to them. Already, MPs are active and interact via community and parish events and outreach programmes. We are in favour of maintaining the status quo, as any move to partition Gibraltar into precincts will complicate the simple system of the open door facility that certainly tends to exist with MPs in Gibraltar. On the point regarding enlarging Parliament, my honourable friend Mr. Seaton has already given this House our views on the matter.
We are making.
I invite you to discuss the House at 2 p.m. or 2:15 p.m.
2:15. We are making a housing session now for an earlier start this afternoon than usual, and the housing session is 2:15.